Welcome, mountain bikers, to another episode of Vital MTB's The Inside Line. And today we have a special guest, Sean Grizz McClendon, former Battle Bus Commander, low budget roller, 2.6 stallion, pro downhill racer, just all around stoke master. I've known Grizz for a long time, and it was a pleasure to finally sit down with him and discuss his whole story. We touch on how he got into mountain bikes, his roots in racing, hosting the first whip contest, the Side Flight Champs. We get into his life-altering injury at U.S. National Champs at Sol Vista in 2010, how it happened, the recovery, the ups and downs, where it's brought him, and how he actually ended up at Deity Components, where he is right now. It's awesome to have guys like Grizz out there in the scene and in the community. And I hope you enjoy the episode. This Vital MTB Inside Line podcast is brought to you by Jensen USA. Shop for great deals and get professional advice on your favorite bikes, components, and riding gear. Over 2 million happy cyclists served since 1994. Visit JensenUSA.com/TheInsideLinePodcast and use code INSIDELINE for 10% off qualifying items. Maxxis Tires, where the rubber meets the dirt. Maxxis makes no compromise tires for any rider, any trail, any time.
That one guitar just blew him away.
Heard some Foreigner on the way here.
Got y'all revved up.
And they had some sticks. Yeah, dude. Pretty rad.
All right, we good on distance now?
Yeah, but point it towards your face a little bit.
Oh, yeah, I'm up now. How's that? Looking better?
Yeah. Tell me, your phone's off. I gotta turn mine off. Tell me how would you call yourself, do you have some redneck roots in you?
Yeah, my lineage definitely fought for the Confederacy. We lost that one.
Okay. All right. I'll just call you a redneck kid far out at East San Diego, Pine Valley. How do you know so many Too Short lyrics and hip hop lyrics?
Well, you got to trace the redneck prior to his redneck roots. I grew up in Chula Vista before Pine Valley, I was very much exposed to the 90s gangster rap and was actually like banned from my old man from listening to rap. So I had to sneak into my older brother's room when he had like the new Too Short tape or Snoop or any of that. Yeah.
Dude, that's sick.
Having a brother who's in his 40s now, with the Too Short tapes.
That's so rad. Spit some Too Short fire.
I knew you were going to come after this one. Get Money in the Ghetto. This is my go-to. I love this one. Abraham Lincoln got shot and died. Freed the slaves, so they put him on the five. To my old-time friend, Hamilton, they put his face on the front of the 10.
That's rad. Oh, man. Grizz, what is up? Sean Grizz McClendon.
What's up, Vital MTB? I'm back.
Grizz is back. Dude, everyone was psyched to see you doing the POVs from Tamarack.
Yeah.
A lot of good comments like, whoa, Grizz, what's going on?
I know. I get a lot of love online, man. I got a lot of love in the mountain bike community. Yeah, I think that's why I'm here and committed my life to it.
Dude, for sure.
That was actually super fun. I've never talked that much while riding ever. Even like coaching, you know, when you're like following riders and going, hey, elbows up, hey, break now. Oh. So I'd never done anything like that. So yeah, definitely props to Claudio and those guys that do it on the regular because it's hard.
Yeah.
It's super hard.
Dude, the courses there looked fun. We'll get into some of that stuff. But I'm freestyling it with you.
I figured we would do this.
Dude, I've known you long enough. We've got enough history. Like, we know enough of the same people that they'll be pretty fun. But yeah, for everyone, this is welcome to Vital MTB's The Inside Line Podcast. I'm Sean Spomer, and I'm with Sean Grizz McClendon.
Hey, yo.
Yeah. And we're in Meridian, Idaho, right next to Boise, Idaho. That's where Grizz hails.
Yeah, and full-blown suburban guy now.
Suburbia.
Two dogs and living with my girlfriend.
That's how we do. Working for Deity.
Working for Deity Components.
Yeah.
9 to 5.
Dude, the place is so cool that other people are moving here. And, yeah, it seems like a neat place to be.
Well, It is pretty neat, but not too neat, if you know what I mean. We're full. Just got to throw it out there. Got to join the Idaho vibe, you know?
Totally, right? Idaho's full. Beat it.
Yeah, but no, Kyle Warner moved to town. You're here now. I'm here. Got a Jason Bull. He's another like pro downhill kid I met earlier this year. He's going to BSU. So, yeah, there's a little bit of a scene starting to develop here in Boise.
Yeah.
So,
pretty sick.
A lot of transplants and some, you know, there's some local rooted dudes and girls in mountain biking that are pretty cool and like just undercover rippers too. Yeah.
Cool. Well, stoked to get into it and kind of see what you think everything and see about where you came from. Talk some story, talk some history. I'd get into riding mountain bikes.
Moving to Pine Valley, California back in 1996.
Okay.
How
old were you?
I was 11 years old. And I didn't immediately get into mountain biking. My older brother actually did. So in the 90s, there was a guy named Ryan Dawson out of Pine Valley. And he used to race for like the Foes Devo team.
Huh.
So, you know, when we moved to Pine Valley, my interests were ice hockey. So I played club ice hockey.
Really?
Yeah, same with like Ryan Howard too.
No way.
Yeah, hockey roots, ice yeah. hockey roots.
Huh.
And I was into skateboarding, okay. heavy into skateboarding. So like all my hockey teammates, we would, you know, play hockey and then go skate. So moving out to the sticks of East County, San Diego, skating on gravel. And this is 90s, dude. Skateboarding was like little wheel.
Yeah,
era.
Small so bearing covers.
Pretty much bearing covers, yeah. That was kind of not many places to skate. But I was also psyched on BMX.
Okay.
And so I got to do a lot more BMX riding. Long short of it, I basically rode my BMX bike until it broke. And
was it just kind of like a Walmartish bike? Was it kind of nice?
Close.
Like, okay.
It was a Diamondback Viper. I've been told that my parents hate me because they bought me that bike, but that's not the case. It's just low budget, man. So rode the Diamondback Viper and basically jumped it to its grave, cracked the frame. And when the frame cracked, it was the same summer that I quit playing ice hockey. Just burnt out on the politics and just had run my course with hockey. So my dad had the wherewithal to realize, like, I got a 12-year-old kid, or I think I was 12 when this all happened, in rural America.
Yeah.
And he's at war with boredom. So that leads to bad things.
Yeah. Describe Pine Valley a little bit. Having never been there, it would be...
Yeah, okay, so...
Having been there, it's easy to understand, but if you haven't been...
If you've never been to Pine Valley, it is pretty consistent with, like, the Midwest, or just small-town America. Population roughly 2,000, 2,500 back then. So it was pretty polarizing from coming from Chula Vista, southwest San Diego, 8 miles north of Tijuana, Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much, you know, Pine Valley is a town where everyone knows everyone, and... You know, all the kids my age, those are the only people they ever knew were themselves. You know, they grew up kindergarten plus. So, small town America, 30 minutes outside of like a big city.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So as like the teenage years came, it was pretty cool because you had you had access to a city once you could drive yourself to the city, mm-hmm. but you could run to the hills and not deal with like any gang violence or like getting shot.
Kind of a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of a big deal, which yeah.
Okay. So did your dad buy you a new bike? Is that what?
Yeah. 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 So, okay. So yeah, cracked the BMX, cracked the Viper and quit hockey. And my dad was like, look, dude, you need something to do. You need a new bike. So what do you want to get? You want to get a BMX bike? Do you want to get like a flatland bike? Do you want a mountain bike? And I was like, well, the mountain bike seems to be a pretty logical thing here because there's a bunch of trails like outside of the backyard and all my homies in town my buddy Brian's jumping his Trek, whatever the heck it was, uh-huh. with his RockShox, you know, pogo stick. He's sending it with bar ends, so I could probably get that done too.
Yeah.
So it was just, and then there was the Ryan Dawson influence of like this hybrid between motocross and BMX. It was like this Foes Weasel downhill bike.
Yeah.
Blew my mind. So I was like, yeah, Dad, let's do the mountain bike.
Hmm.
So we started off on a Schwinn Mesa,
ooh.
Which was like their rock bottom.
Yeah.
Like,
say, entry not very level. High level.
Yeah. So I definitely started off entry level mountain bike, but,
how long did that bike last? I mean, well, dude, if you're breaking your BMX bike.
Yeah. Yeah. So that frame lasted probably a year and a half, maybe 2 years. But Schwinn was rad. So I cracked that frame, and I think they upgraded me to the Moab after that. So I got a frame, and then, you know, upgraded to the RockShox Judy SL fork, which I thought back then, I had no idea what SL stood for. I thought it stood for slalom. I was like, yeah, slalom, sick. That's
but it was like super light, right? Because
there was a Judy DH, and I was like, well, SL, is that slalom? Yeah, that works for me.
Yeah,
that sounds
sick. Judy XC, right? A Judy XC DH, SL, yeah.
Slalom. So, yeah, no idea. And but, man, I became, like, instantly enthralled with mountain biking. And got a subscription to Mountain Bike Action and just became a student of all things mountain biking. Hooked.
Did you get into the tech of it and the maintenance and all that, like with the fork, or did you just kind of ride? And
that came later. Early on, I was just really, really, really psyched on the racers and the riders. I mean, dude, that era in the 90s was killer.
Yeah.
There were some heroes, and just the team aspect, I don't know. Yeah, I wasn't like tech and figuring all that stuff. Ultimately, mountain biking is like kind of a self-sufficient sort of like sport. So you have to learn the maintenance side of things, which led to like, hey, kid, here's a book for Christmas on how to maintain your bicycle.
Like Zen and the Art of Mountain Biking.
Yeah. So, mountain biking was rad for that. I mean, because I really wasn't mechanical at all until I got a mountain bike and had to dive in and figure stuff out once it broke.
Yep. So where did your Moab take you? And like, let's kind of go through the timeline of
So let's say, I think that first mountain bike was purchased in 1998, and there was actually a race that was pretty local to Pine Valley out in Lake Marina called Sagebrush Safari.
Okay.
And
was it an XC race?
XC and downhill.
Oh, okay.
They had no slalom, which bummed me out, but there was XC and downhill. So
we go in, what made you want to, like, what drew you to slalom so much?
Oh, well, because I was terrified of downhill, and I only had a hardtail.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, like the racers, like Dave Cullinan had a huge impression on me initially. Okay. You know, obviously riding the Schwinn Toyota team was like, those were my like gods, right? Yeah. Like these are my people. So Cully's the sickest, seems to be sickest of slalom. Although he rips it downhill, he's a slalom guy. Yep. So slalom seems to be like where it's at.
So it was kind of like within your reach of like what you wanted to do, the bike you had.
Yeah.
That sort of
thing. Yeah. And I think it reminded me a lot of BMX too, which I was like, I had ambitions for BMX, but that just wasn't, you know, when I was doing the ice hockey thing, my family was committed to that. So adding anything to it was out of the question.
Okay.
But I think just the head-to-head racing format made a lot of sense to me. You know, you can see a competitor, it was exciting, and there was jumps and like berms and ruts and there was like a lot less body armor too. You didn't have to wear spandex.
Yeah.
You know, everybody kind of was wearing like looked like they were like racing BMX in a cross country helmet.
Yeah, so basically, right? Yeah.
It was super exciting.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so Sagebrush Safari. Did you enter?
I entered. So Sagebrush 1999.
Okay.
Line up. I think there was three kids total in my class, which they used to call it Junior Olympic.
Okay.
So Junior Olympic 14 and under. And
that's sick.
So I'm racing two kids, and these kids had sick bikes. So I think these kids all were racing AM Cups up at Big Bear.
Okay.
But I remember, so I show up, I've got this, you know, $500 hardtail with all the aftermarket parts and accessories added into it.
Yeah.
And I've got my Schwinn Toyota team jersey, Lifer jersey, full sleeve.
Yeah.
Borrowed a Moto full face helmet from, I think, my friend Travis. Yeah. Borrowed some Fox 180 or 360 leathers, whatever, from like the early 90s from my homie Chris Cram.
Okay.
So my kit was like every color in the Pantone book. On like a, you know, just this
with
basic,
every logo and yeah,
every logo, yeah, like just repping his, you know, just repping it.
Yeah.
And I remember this one kid. So one kid had a Santa Cruz like a Bullet, you know. And like remember Tyler McCall when he was like dirt cover era?
Yeah,
you know? It was like one of those little Bullets, you know.
Okay, like but the size small, like size, it didn't have the curved top tube and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sick bike though.
Yeah,
so he was a little bit younger than me, and these kids all had dope kits too, you know. And then another kid was on like a mountain cycle, whatever it was.
Yeah, like San Andreas or something probably.
Yeah. I'm just like, wow, dude, these guys have sick bikes. Like,
heck yeah.
What am I doing here? And anyway, one of the kids was like, so do you like race? And I'm like, no, this is my my first race ever. They're like, are you a, you like a cross country guy or a downhill guy? I'm like, I don't know. I just ride mountain bikes. So, yeah. You know, probably more cross country because I got to pedal up to my parents aren't always around to shuttle. So yeah I pedal a lot, I guess. So anyway, I ended up waxing those guys.
Really?
And this is like, this was enduro before enduro, man. Mm-hmm. Like, this was like a, dude, I don't know what the stats are on that old Sagebrush course, but it took me probably 12 minutes or something like that to get down the hill. You started off with like a climb, you know, it's a moto trail, it's just like a whooped out motorcycle mm-hmm. trail, berms formed by motorcycles, whoops formed by motorcycles, yeah. and some rock slabs in between. So you literally start off, and if I remember the first minute and a half, just being like, oh my God, this hurts.
Yeah. Like, had you ever pushed yourself that hard before?
Never pushed myself that hard. You know, like a 45 second shift on a hockey rink, like didn't prep me for that. All okay. that much. I was gassed 45 seconds in, but, just kept chugging along and ended up winning that race and was like, yeah, this sport is sick.
Yeah.
I'm good at it. Like, I'm instantly, I won.
Yeah.
Like,
especially against kids with like flossed out bikes. And
yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Did,
yeah.
Did you remember their reaction or anything? Like
devastation. It was pure devastation. Yeah. And I honestly kind of felt bad for the kid with the Santa Cruz.
Oh.
So it was a 2-run format, right? Yeah. And like, I think it was combined or I can't remember exactly, but whatever. Yeah. 2 runs. And after the first run, going up to the top for our second run, the kid with the Santa Cruz was like, hey dude, can you not pass me on this run? Like, my dad yells at me if I get passed.
Oh dude.
I was like, well, that's cool. My dad's not here and I'm stoked because the part of this racing thing that's sick is there's no kooky parents here uh-huh. yelling at their kids.
Yeah. Except for this guy.
Yeah. Right? Your dad sounds like he sucks.
Oh man. That's a bummer.
Did you pass him?
I passed him. Yeah. Yeah. It's dog eat dog life, man.
It is, dude. Competitor racing. All right. So now you're hooked.
Instantly hooked. Yeah. So I was, a freshman in high school when I really got into downhill racing. So year 2000, enter my first amateur cup racing series. We've upgraded from the hardtail to a specialized FSR, which is dated at that time. This is like, I'm on the 98 FSR Elite. Okay. The red one with uh-huh. the Manitou Experts. I'm like, watch out, dude.
Uh-huh.
Watch out.
Totally.
I'm like mini Palm, mini Boris right here.
For sure.
Yeah, I'm coming for you guys. So, Big Bear was like terrifying to me too, you know, because back then you had access to the sport by way of Outdoor Life Network and like mountain bike
and magazines.
Magazines. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for most of us, it was Mountain Bike Action, which covered everything. Not enough downhill, in my opinion, back then or ever, but it was enough to, you know, keep me aware of what was going on, bikes and so on and so forth. But Big Bear was like terrifying to me. I'm like, dude, this is it. I'm stepping up to the big leagues.
Yeah.
We got a chairlift involved with this racing. Like, this is where all the bad people, like all the badasses come from Big Bear. Like, this is heavy.
Yeah.
And entered that junior Olympic class 16 and under first year on the specialized. I think I got a sponsorship midway through from Hannebrink.
Serious?
Yeah, but like this is like a grassroots deal, you know, it was like 50% off or whatever in a jersey.
But still,
But yeah, you know,
do you remember how you did?
Yeah, so I was like, I started off kind of just outside the top five.
Mm-hmm.
First race, I was like sixth or seventh or something like that. And then,
do you remember what class sizes were? Like how many kids there were?
In the teens.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. I think it was like,
and maybe this is 14 like, and under?
That's 16 and under, I think, at that time.
Okay.
Because I was racing age 15. Yeah, racing age 15. So 16 and under. Yeah, I think there was always like more than 10 kids.
Dude, sick.
It was rad, man. And like I think that year Daniel Umlin was in the class. Cody Warren had bumped up to junior expert. So I only like in that year 2000, I only raced Cody once at Sagebrush.
Okay.
He waxed me by like a lot. Uh-huh. But I was like a distant second place on that one. But then going to the Am Cups, I was just outside of the top five, and then within like a couple races, I was in the top five and like getting some podiums.
Mm-hmm.
So that first year, 2000, was like my first real race season. Strictly amateur cups, and I think maybe like one or two of them was like a Cal State round.
Okay, and was it all at Big Bear?
All at Big Bear, yeah. So 2000, I did Sagebrush, and then only amateur cups at Big Bear, and like maybe Fall Classic or something like that. And then 2001, things got a little bit more serious. I did my first Norba National at Snow Summit.
Okay.
Did Seattle Classic in 2001.
Ooh, traveling.
Yeah, started to travel a little bit in 2001, yep. 16 years old, and then the driver's license came into effect then. Okay. So then for us, it was rad. Like, for me, I was like, dude, I don't want my parents involved with my racing. Like, it was cool with hockey, but it got weird with hockey, so I want mountain biking to be my thing.
Yeah.
And so that 2001 year is when things got really, really cool.
Okay, because you got a license and you're out of there.
Yeah.
Like,
go race. Yeah, like, race weekend, cool, you get to borrow the caravan. Just remember, you got to stop twice on the drive up because it overheats. But yeah, you know, like I would load up either the Ford Festiva or the Dodge Caravan and go racing.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mom loved coming to the races and like loved it back then. Like the parents, like they all got along and liked each other.
Yeah.
So it was kind of this really cool mountain biking racing was cool. Cause I think most of the parents were like, hey, this is the first sport we've done with our kid. Where the parents are bitching.
Yeah.
Like, we're partying in the parking lot and enjoying ourselves.
While the kids go do their thing.
Yeah. Huh.
So did you start meeting people then? Like, I mean, you said you met Cody and stuff, but like, how was the connection with other riders?
Yeah. Connection in 2001, it was still pretty, I think we were still kind of like awkward with one another, you know, but obviously I met, you know, Cody Warren, Corey Gustafson, Daniel Umlin. Those were like the gnarly guys for the class. Yeah. Ian Odom out of Big Bear. He was a big stick.
Yep.
Taylor Sage, Garrick Anderson, those guys.
I think Garrick. Yeah.
Yeah. Garrick, man, the most talented guy that, unfortunately is not racing any longer. We didn't really all start clicking until like 2002.
Okay.
And really hanging out outside of races.
Okay.
So like in 2001, I would still turn up with homies from like high school, you know, they would come up with me and we were like hooligans, dude, compared to all these other dorks going to Big Bear. We're like redneck East County kids, you know? So, by 2002, things got really cool.
Okay.
I think one thing, the highlight of 2001 for me, and those of you that used to race at Big Bear will definitely recall this with fond memories, but the 12-hour downhill in 2001.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was the first year they did it at Snow Summit. So this is like a 12-hour downhill race. As many laps as you can get in the day, that's, you win.
And you race solo?
No.
Or were you on a team?
No, I was on a team.
Yep.
And so it was a 4-man team.
Mm-hmm.
And basically in 2001, like I was the guy in the junior Olympic class. Like I won everything. I won the amateur cup title. I won the Cal State title. Beat Justin Lofton, Justin Lofton was like, he's this badass off-road car racer nowadays and has been for a long time. But yeah, Justin was like a part of our junior group coming up.
Okay.
So anyway, there was two junior teams at the 12 hour. And the team that we were racing against was Taylor Sage, Justin Lofton, Anthony Cuomo, and Brian Webster. I can't believe I remember all that stuff in sequence, right? So like the other team was basically all of my competition.
Yep.
And my team was two of my homies from high school that have never raced mountain bikes in their life. never did again.
And they never did again after that.
One dude never did again. I think my homie Brian Jones maybe did like one or two races. Yep. I think he did like Sagebrush once or twice. but then my homie James Moore. So, and James was like not as fast as like us. Like we were like pretty, not junior expert fast, but like we were like the faster kids. Yep. Yeah. Getting ready to go junior X. So, but again, like we were all punk kids, 16 years old, 17 years old. Uh-huh. And it was just us. And like Taylor and those guys, all their parents are there. Like we camped out at Snow Summit. One of my friends slept on a chairlift at Summit. Like
we ended up
going to a house party up there. Like, as teenagers, you know, like we're already like chasing chicks and parties. Like,
uh-huh. And your parents are just like, whatever, see you, take the car, don't overheat it. That's about it.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 Because we weren't stupid like drinking and driving or anything like that. But yeah, we were definitely trying to sniff out the trim of Big Bear and catch a buzz if you could. Uh-huh. But that was like the highlight. Yeah. Like, dude, this is sick. Like racing with my friends. Like this is amazing.
Yeah. You know, so how'd you guys fare against the Square Kids, T-Sage, on Team Square?
I think they beat us by a couple of laps. My one of my teammates, Brian Jones, like got lost on the mountain. We were waiting.
Oh, man,
We were racing Westridge, and he ended up like over on like Log Chute or like literally. So homie is blind in one eye. That I'm going to say that's his handicap. Like he somehow went off course and went all the way to the other side of the mountain.
Oh, man.
And then like on our second or third lap, my homie Pat is on the chairlift going up. He comes down from his run. He's like, dude, Brian's walking back to the racetrack from like the long wrong shoot side of the hill. Yeah. The so we were off to a little slow start, but but we won in fun. And I think for sure the crowd appreciated us more than Sage in those squares.
Awesome. So are you in a class like that, like, is the Hannebrink thing what you're getting? Are you getting more than that?
Yeah. So by 01, it was just like a little grassroots Hannebrink deal. Oh, and then also there was Sean Speed from a bike shop in Alpine. I think it was Let It Ride bike shop, mm-hmm. or, you know, one of those. He had a couple different things. So I had like a shop level sponsorship, mm-hmm. which was more like a mentorship than an actual sponsorship. Okay. You know, he'd hook me up at his cost on certain parts, but more than anything, Sean was coaching me how to maintain the bike and like what parts to buy, knowing that downhill you're going to break stuff. Yeah. So this is what breaks the least, you know, like certain square taper bottom brackets. Mm-hmm. Like he was just really kind of coaching me through like, this is what you need to be running if you're racing.
Okay.
So you can afford a $20 derailleur if you break it rather than like this XTR stuff over here, however much it cost.
Huh. Interesting.
But beyond that, then my sponsorship and even income were the same thing. So by 2002, I'm working for a guy named Gary Hickman, who owned a company called Precision Billet, with doing business names as like Bombshell, Avent, and all that stuff. So by the time I'm a junior in high school, racing junior expert, Cody Warren is the dude, and I'm working next door to Cody Warren. After school.
Yeah.
Right. So like I'm over here
to pay for your sport.
To pay for the sport and to just keep my parents at bay from like, you know, going into too much debt or spending too much money on me, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone who's got siblings that's grew up in sports understands like the dynamic there. Parents try to juggle all the kids and make them feel equally important.
Yeah.
But, you know, in my situation, I was definitely reminded that I was the Silver Spoon kid and my brother and sister weren't getting as much like cash attention. So I always had this kind of drive to provide what I could, you know? Like, dude, I would sell my school lunches in high school for money. Like my mom loved us so much where she didn't want us eating the crap at the schools, whatever the state would feed you.
Yeah.
So she would make my sister and I school lunches.
Yeah.
All of us. She made us lunches. So by the time I'm in high school, I'm selling my BLTs for on a low day, $2, as much as $8 a day.
Shut
at school.
No way. So what would you eat then?
Just buy some crappy I had carrots. I had, you know, some crackers. And then I would take like a dollar of profit, go to the ASB store and get some peanut M&Ms or a Reese's peanut butter cup.
High school.
And then I'd go home and immediately start chowing down lunch.
Yeah, right.
Awesome. I was a little husky back then. So I was like weight conscious. You know, like I had to get down to race weight. Huh. All these other wrestlers were starving themselves. So I figured I could sell my lunch, not pack on the unnecessary weight
and cash in.
Dude,
that's sick. So when did you feel like it was time to pursue it? Cause you pursued being a pro racer, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Pretty much from the get go, like when I was probably 17, that first year of junior expert, I was like, I can do this. Hmm. I mean, Kyle Strait was already in approaching the peak of his career, the first peak of his career. And, you know, Cody was already on Factory Haro. Corey Gustafson was on Factory Foes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Sage was on like the Insane Wayne Bob squad. Like, mm-hmm. I knew that our generation was special.
Mm-hmm. Like you were actually conscious of that back then.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Huh. Absolutely. I knew that what Kyle was doing, Cameron Zink, the McCalls.
Yeah.
We had such a sick crew growing up. I mean, that group of riders changed this sport forever.
For sure.
And like, no one talks about it. It's true. Like I say this all the time, like Kyle Strait, if you could single out one person who changed the whole destiny of mountain biking, I would say Kyle Strait.
Why?
Because look at how many careers were then opened up. Like companies were invested in this child prodigy.
Hmm.
Next thing you know, Cameron Zink's getting deals. Cameron McCall's getting deals. Cody Warren's getting deals. Like
so there was basically this domino like
effect of like young riders getting deals.
Okay. So like, this youth has it. Companies see it. And so other companies are like, we need a young kid too. like that kind of thing. And of course, everyone was talented.
Yeah. And I think if you would ask me that back then, I think companies weren't giving enough love.
Sure.
I definitely felt like there was a laundry list of us like not getting nearly the support that some of our competitors were.
Yeah.
And we're out here in the parking lot, you know, trying to fix a rim or whatever and make it happen kind of thing. So perceptions changed, but yeah, definitely back then I was like, what's up, man?
Just cocky kid.
Yeah. Not even cocky because I wasn't winning races, but you know, I was like a top five, top 10 guy at the Nationals, but I'm like, come on, dude, I need some tires.
Yeah.
I got mom and dad screaming at me about how expensive I am.
So what, like in that kind of, was it Junior X or were you up to pro then? Like
this no, kind yeah, of junior expert. So yeah. So like when I was 17, I wanted to make a run at it then, but at the same time, I always looked at the racing thing as like a very short term deal, right? Because like simultaneously, Kyle Strait's getting deals and he's getting money, mm-hmm. but at the same time, the Norman National Circuit is dying, right? So like in 2003, most of our last year of juniors, like Chevy trucks pulled out, like the writing on the wall for this recession that happened in 2008 was like, it was happening in mountain biking in 2003. Mm-hmm. Right. So at that time where I was like, I'm, you know, 17, it's like 02, 03. I want to go into the sport. These corporate dollars were also leaving the sport, right? Like the global racing team disappeared. Mm-hmm. Schwinn Toyota, like Toyota backed out, like all the car money bailed, right?
Yeah.
So I knew that for me, like I'm not Kyle Strait, I'm not Cameron Zink, I'm going to have to be smart about this. Hmm. So at the same, right, so I was saying I worked for Gary Hickman, so I worked in a machine shop. You know, I was actually hands-on with like building parts. So I always saw myself probably working in this industry. And at what capacity? I knew I didn't want to operate a machine for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But I knew that my love for this sport and this industry was probably never going to taper, mm-hmm. and it really hasn't.
Yeah.
So I think early on in my teenage years, and you know, too, like another influence, I guess, with my thinking was my parents. They definitely made it clear that they didn't see this as a career opportunity, mm-hmm. and there was always concern for like, well, what's your friend Kyle going to do when he's not getting paid to ride his bike anymore?
Sure.
You don't want to be in that predicament.
Yeah.
We don't want to see you in that predicament.
Yeah. Legit concern, especially with,
absolutely,
you know, not knowing what mountain biking could have been or is going to be.
I try to kind of spread that message too, to like riders that have approached me for mentoring or whatever. Hmm. Like, hey man, think about this long term. Like have a plan, because you're not going to retire on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're going to see anybody retire from mountain biking.
Yeah, probably.
You, even Gwen, you know, Petey, you know, like, look at Petey. Like, Petey's always going to be involved with mountain biking.
Yeah.
I want to buy some of your sealant, Petey. I'm ready to do this right now. I was legitimately thinking about buying Petey sealant this morning too. I'm not even kidding.
Do it. Support the man.
Yeah. That's it. So yeah, I always had just kind of a long term, like, hey, I want to make my dent in racing, because mm-hmm. it was like a personal thing. I just felt like, hey, I've got this ability and this talent. I'm going to pretty much kick myself in the ass forever if I don't give this 100%.
Okay.
So, but yeah, like at that level, you know, at the level I was at, kind of on the brink, it was always that like just year to year figuring it out kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like
never any multi-year deals arrangements to make it easy.
Yeah. I never had anything like that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. And so, okay, you guys are coming up. Norba's sort of fallen out a little mm-hmm. bit. And then, like, I kind of want to get to the, like, the 2-6 Stallions kind of era.
Yeah.
So that's what, 05-ish, 06?
Yeah. Two, 05 was when 2-6 came about. Prior to 2-6... was the low budget Rollers.
Oh yeah, the LBR. LBR. That's right. Yeah.
LBR was the original that we ended up forming 2-6 because Kyle Strait and Cameron Zink felt excluded. They weren't low budget Rollers. Them fools were paid. So we had to have an identity change.
All right, wait, back to LBR. That's like you, who, Taylor, Sanjay?
Yeah, Taylor,
like,
who's Taylor, all of this? Yeah, so low budget Rollers consisted of Taylor Sage, Sanjay, Mad Dog, Garrick Anderson, and myself.
Okay.
And then there was just a lot of honorary members, you know. Sure. There was a lot of people who were just down for the cause.
Okay.
And so, yeah, 2004 is when the Battle Bus came into play.
Yeah, okay. Explain what that is.
So the Battle Bus was a 1979 Class C motorhome, which is like the van body with the cab over thing. And when it was first purchased for $4,000, it was in great operating condition. Actually bought it from a friend of the Swangans. So JD and Mad Dog's mom worked with a guy who we bought this motorhome from.
Okay.
And I mean, the dude had it all. Like, motor had like 44,000 miles on it. He had like a 3-inch straight pipe exhaust, like sick. Yeah, like, I can't, it had like a dope carburetor. I can't remember. I want to say it was an Edelbrock, but I know it wasn't. I just want to say it was.
Let the legend live.
Yeah. It was breathing on a Edelbrock or Holly, whatever. It was sick. But yeah, so then we proceeded to just kind of spray paint this thing. So that LBR road trip was like just random sayings were spray painted. We had like R.I.P.O.D.B. on the side. I can't remember if Sage or Sanjay made like Tupac stencils, but we had like Tupac blasted all over him. And then so we set off on tour in 2004.
Okay.
And I want to touch on that because some magic happened that summer.
Okay.
And
when you say on tour, was it like to follow nationals?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we followed a couple of Norba nationals and then Crankworks.
Okay.
I think it was called Crankworks, right? This was
in 04.
Yeah. It evolved from Joyride to Crankworks.
Yeah.
So we were definitely made our mark on parking lot 4 at Whistler.
Okay.
Yeah. Camped out there. And then the last leg of that tour, so this was like a month long tour that the riders on it were Taylor Sage, a coworker of his time, at the time, this guy he worked with, Hungus.
Okay.
So Hungus was only on tour with us for a week. So he was pretty much our driver and alcohol supplier because he was like 21 or 22. And we're like, I'm 19. Sage is like 18. Garrick's 18. Amazing. We could have a whole podcast just on this one summer.
I'm sure. go into it. We got time.
Yeah. So we go to Whistler, we were just like hellions. You know what I mean? Like we were riding the bike park in like spandex suits, like these like one piece Avion road, like women's road team.
You've got like that
suits.
Bright yellow, kind of almost like tie dye sort of looking thing. I have a photo of you finishing Garbanzo or something, or the airline or the A line race in that. Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah. So we were just like there to make a statement of like, hey, you can
screw around,
just screwing around. Yeah, screwing around. This sport is clearly dying, and we're gonna make it fun.
Yeah.
So the highlight of that summer though. This is like some real accomplishment. So Garrick Anderson was on that tour. I don't know if I mentioned that earlier, but so Garrick is a badass, right? So Garrick's winning that, like definitely a contender for the Junior Worlds team, you know, full privateer effort racing on last year's Intense M1.
Mm-hmm.
And dude, so by the time we get to Aspen, that was the last leg. Yeah. So I think that tour we went to Sandpoint, like Schweitzer, Whistler, and then Aspen.
Okay.
I think it was in that
order.
But anyway, Aspen was the last stop, and it was also a qualifying race. Like I think one of the last qualifying races for the Junior Worlds team at that time. And in the early 2000s, USA Cycling would actually, I think, comp maybe one or two racers basically trip to Worlds.
Huh.
So for like Garrick, Garrick was like, I got to win this race, or even if I get selected for the team, I'm not going. Like I have to win this race. So long story short, on ragtag Maxxis Minions, I mean like they're shot out. Garrick Anderson put 10 seconds to factory Kyle Strait at Aspen, pitting out of the Battle Bus on a Top Ramen and Pabst Blue Ribbon diet. Gets to go to Worlds, free ride by USA Cycling. And I think he raced in board shorts, Danish pants, and a white t-shirt. Put 10 seconds into you, Kyle. 10. And then freaking T Sage and Sanjay were panhandling for money, for gas money to get us home the next day. They were like trying to sell Gatorades that were being given for free at the finish line.
Oh man.
I think Chopper from Smith at that time like ended up going to the ATM and giving us $100 cash to get home.
Dude, sick.
How cool is that? It was sick until the next morning. when we woke up in 110 degree heat outside of Vegas with the battle bus all broken down.
Oh, really?
So we'll get into this leg of the story, man.
All right,
so
yeah, let's hear.
We got triumph. Garrick Anderson's qualified for Worlds.
Yep, the high.
The hype is high. I mean, the mood is strong in the battle bus. We're going home. It's been a successful trip. All of us have been on the road for a month and had like the most fun of our lives ever. It's just, dude, high school graduate kids with no parents. It was amazing.
Hmm.
So I think I performed the worst that weekend at Aspen. So I got the graveyard driving shift.
Yep.
You know, drive through the night. By the time the sun is starting to rise, we're outside of like that. We're by that Moapa Indian Reservation.
Okay.
You know, like 35 miles north of Vegas or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like last stop to nothing.
Sure.
Battle bus starts chugging on me. It's like starting to sputter. I'm like, no, what? This thing's been bulletproof. What's going on? So long story short, the Swangans were on their way back to San Diego as well.
Okay.
Which is eventually where we're heading. So, and John Swangan's like super mechanically inclined, knows motorhomes. They had a motorhome. So he knew what the deal was. So it was basically clogged fuel filters.
Okay.
So the motor wasn't getting gas. So we waited at that gas station for hours. Sanjay and Taylor are like blowing everything up. They're blowing fireworks like crazy, dude. Like I'm like my head like in the motor and they're blowing off firecrackers. Like I'm just like extremely agitated. And it's like, dude, it's 115 degrees. It was so hot.
Yeah.
So the Swangans arrive and John Swangan gets in. Basically John starts driving. And I think at some point, long story short, we start limping the motorhome down Highway 15, Interstate 15 South,
mm-hmm.
towards Vegas. And we're looking for like a Pep Boys or whatever, you know, to get our parts and get on the road. Well, it gets to a point where the motor's not getting gas at all.
Okay. And he can't get in there and like clean the filter out or anything. It's too complicated.
Exactly. Yeah, too complicated. The filters need replaced.
Yep.
So... Oh, and I had AAA too, so we couldn't get towed. So we were kind of screwed. Uh-huh. Like we had to figure this out. So we get the Gatorade water bottles that they're giving out for free at the Norbus,
mm-hmm.
and the Swangans had a 5-gallon jug of gas like on their trailer. So we basically just filled up these Gatorade bottles with gasoline, pulled what's called the doghouse, you know, like in the vans, like you pull out what's called a doghouse and your motor's exposed.
Yeah, like between the passenger and driver's seat, right?
Exactly.
There.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We then have to take the top off the carburetor, the Edelbrock or Holley or whatever it was, and we're pouring gas straight down the carb.
Dude, you're being the gas tank.
Yeah.
Inside the cab of the motorhome.
That's like a sauna, legitimately a sauna, dude. It was 115 outside, cabin temp was like probably, yeah, like 180. It was hot as hell.
Are you scared you're going to catch on fire?
All right. So, yeah, this is the point where Sage and Sanjay bail from the battle bus, and they go to the luxury of air conditioning and props DVDs in the Swangan Durango.
I wouldn't expect anything less from Taylor.
Yeah, Sanjay, exactly. Like, all right. Yeah, Sanjay was actually shocked. Like, I was like, wow, yeah, darkness, you're pretty soft right now. I thought you would be, like, on the roof of this thing doing the Teen Wolf thing, and you're in a Durango sucking on air conditioning. What? Weak. So John Swangan's driving. Garrick, this guy who's just qualified for Junior Worlds,
yep.
is the gas man. And then I'm behind these guys with a fire extinguisher in case stuff goes sideways.
Shut up.
Yeah. Yeah. So we run out of gas, or like we need to do a refill of gas, you know, in the Gatorade bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another guy who's broken down. So we pick this dude up. Homie's got like 8 teeth left in his face. But he's now our pathfinder. He knows where like the closest,
okay.
you know, car, whatever car park shop is.
Yeah.
So this dude Toothy starts just like that. We had a bag. I just remember like this picture. Like if you can try to visualize this, we're all sweating bullets. There's two grown ass men and two
you guys are teenage kids. Come on, huh?
In this motorhome. And yeah, basically the dude like grabs a bag of sunflower seeds and just starts spraying sunflower seeds all over the interior. We're like, dude, weak.
Like he's chewing on them and spitting inside?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah, just spraying them. And like, yeah, conversations got into like whorehouses. Like things were very good. It got super weird. And then next thing I know, there's like a boom, like a backfire. And this blue flame shoots up from the carburetor.
Oh.
Well, good thing I got this fire extinguisher because we might need it.
Yeah.
So,
but you didn't use it then.
Didn't use it then. A couple minutes later, boom, another backfire. Garrick panics, grabs a wrist full of Gatorade gasoline, and just the entire cabin ignites. Just
shut
fireball.
Bullshit.
No, that's serious. Fireball. So there I go with the extinguisher and just panic spray. Douse the flame. And so once the black smoke and white smoke settle, Garrick is just shaking with this like gasoline lit, like a Molotov cocktail.
Yeah, in a fire.
Shaking. And John Swan goes, bah, bah, ah, because I hit John in the back of the head with the fire extinguisher, with the retardant. So he's shaking this fire retardant off his head, sees the Molotov cocktail, and just throws it out the window.
No way.
So things didn't get any worse. And we assessed the damage. There was no more damage than was already done. So we just kept on giving her. And
Technique kept working, even though you sprayed the stuff, the fire extinguisher everywhere?
Yeah. You had to keep going. Had to keep on going. We made it to whatever, AutoZone or Kragen or whatever it was.
Yeah.
John Swangen fixed the fuel filter problem, and off we were. Boom. Went home.
That was
the end of the low-budget Rollers tour, number one.
Dude, serious. Get some of that zinc and straight money in your program here quick
before
you guys catch on fire. That is insane.
It was heavy. I've got photo evidence, too, man.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I think it's hanging up on the...
I've never heard that before.
Oh, that's why we're doing this podcast.
Well, yeah.
Dude. Thank you guys for letting me share that one. That's one of my more proud stories in life.
Oh, my goodness. Dude, we're done. Thanks, everyone. All right. Before we go into more of the timeline, hearing stories like this, I have my memories, which are not nearly as epic as that of just traveling with Maddie and the Big Crank dudes, going around to races and whatever. Your experience is ludicrous. But
well, thank you.
Do you think kids will have that kind of experience anymore? Do you think there are people out there risking it or just being as dirtball as you guys?
I'm probably
just getting old, and it seems like I say this every episode, but can it still happen that way?
Anything's possible. Now, is anyone on the 2018 USA Cycling Junior Downhill team carrying a Molotov cocktail right now? No. No. And I don't think any of them are getting away paid. USA Cycling cut that too.
Yeah, there's that.
That's a totally different world, I think, out there, and kids are in some ways crazier and in other ways not even nearly close.
Yeah, or you guys would have been documenting every second of it anyway, Molotov in one hand, phone in the other.
Yeah, if social media existed back then, we would have broken it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's crazy. Did he go to Worlds?
Garrick went to Worlds, and I can't remember. Garrick went to Worlds 2 years, so 2003 and 2004, and he was inside the top 20 both times, with complications.
Yeah.
Sidebar,
what happened to him? Where'd he go?
Yeah, Garrick basically after 2007 went to work. That was it. You know, he kind of just reached the end of the road and... with racing, he had a lot of parental pressure too, to get on with
just
it.
Be normal kind of,
yeah,
whatever.
Get to work, go make some money and get out of the house kind of thing.
Yep.
And I think he having those ups early on in juniors and seeing some of the successes of guys like Kyle and Cameron and the McCalls and stuff. I don't know if he felt cheated or what. I can't speak on behalf of Garrick.
Sure.
But
basically he went to work, and that's why.
He went to work and that was it.
Plus, 2007, 2008, the best of the best are having a hard time making it.
Downhill racing was in a serious state of depression.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Enter Zinc and Straight and 2-6 Stallions.
Yeah. That's when things got real.
So what happened? Were you guys just all friends from racing?
Yeah, we were definitely all friends from growing up at the Norbus, you know? So, because Zinc wasn't coming down for amateur cups.
Yeah.
Kyle got us started with amateur cups and other in Fontana and stuff like that. But, we were just from the same generation. And I think we all legitimately liked each other, outside of the bike thing.
The hooliganism.
We were definitely all birds of a feather and had similar influences and were kind of attracted to these party animal, like the Wildcats, you know, like that was a snowboard crew that I think was a big influence on the old 2-6 Stallions.
Okay.
We were like, we need to be like these guys for mountain biking. Like this sport needs a kick in the ass.
Was there like a conscious thought like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We need to kick this sport in the ass and hard.
Working at Decline at the time, I was at least like around you guys or like around the spirit of it all and kind of knew what was going on. Like I was plugged in. I don't know if I would have been if I wasn't at Decline, but it seemed like you guys were trying to stir it up.
Totally. Yeah, that was
it. Did it ever go too far? I kind of talked to Scott about this a little bit, like some of the articles and like trying to call out like the Godfathers because they're still
the Rocky Mountain Oysters.
Kind of. Is that what you called them? Yeah,
we went far.
There was that weird, time in slopestyle where it's like, you're like Vanderham or Wade, like on a slopestyle course going against like Zink and Kyle, like just, it wasn't sorted out yet. And so like you guys, the new kids were, seemed like you're kind of trying to push the old dudes out. Like, was it?
Yeah. I think, you know, in hindsight, I think we could have done things a little bit more tastefully, but dude, we were rogue teenage kids.
For sure. Yeah.
You got to learn the hard way when you're like that, you know, that's the only way you learn. So I definitely remember with that We're Here article in Decline.
Yeah.
Sage, Sanjay, and I were basically given the green light to say whatever we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And Kyle and Cameron had to be a little bit more PC. Dude, Kyle was making a ton of cash at that time.
Yeah.
And Cameron was on his way up. So, you know, obviously I think the goal was to really like propel those dudes, Kyle and Cam, of like, hey, dude, these are the guys of free ride. And these guys are freestyle mountain biking, not this like looking like a sperm down a steep hill, squiggling your back wheel. You know what I mean? But I do say that with all due respect to those guys now. And obviously, you know, you got to respect your roots and your elders. So if Schley or Richie or any of you guys, I just said Schley and Richie the same. But no, we're all cool with those guys.
Yeah, and it was a tough time. Like were you doing big hucks or were you doing like tech stuff? Like it was just a weird time.
Yeah.
It wasn't sorted out. So,
and like you said,
everyone was young and stupid. So.
Yeah. And I think we kind of knew that like, hey, good press or bad press, like all press is good press kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, so we can just, if nothing else, get a rise out of people.
Yeah.
Which I think is something that definitely Taylor and I are kind of naturally, dude, I can't escape it, man. Like I have to mess with people and get a rise out of people at times, you know?
Does it get you in trouble now?
Oh, if absolutely. I mean, with my chick all the time. I'm very lucky that Connie puts up with me.
Push the buttons. So, okay. I know there's a couple years in here, but I kind of want to transition from 2-6 Stallions, that time in your life, to like Sol Vista and the injury and all that stuff. Like kind of what went on in there? Because you kept racing the whole time. Like
I did. Yeah. So Spoma, there's been a couple times in my life where I've thought that I've come to the end of the road with mountain biking.
Yeah.
And every time I've been to that point of where this is it, I'm going to have to move on with my life. This is going to break me. Something's come up, like an opportunity for me to actually progress in this industry has come up. Every time I get to that point where I'm like, I'm done. I'm out.
Yeah.
I've exhausted this. Something comes up. So that first moment, I'm driving to Sea Otter Classic in 2007 with my dad. I have some support from Avent Bombshell, which was, you know, an employer of mine at that time. So I'm like working and racing for Gary.
I didn't realize you worked for him too.
Okay. Worked and rode for him.
Yeah.
So I literally think like, oh man, dude, I've got a frame, some wheels, some tires. Like I don't even have a complete bike and I'm going to this race. Like this is probably going to be the end of the road for me. I'm going to have to like commit to culinary school. And
was that something you wanted to do?
That was plan B.
Okay.
I guess for the record, I should state that like out of high school, my family gave me terms for racing. And the terms were, look, you got to go to work. You need to go to college And if you do those two things, we'll support your racing to the extent that we can.
Okay.
Right. So that's when the battle bus came about. Like, so that was my dad, dude. Like,
sure.
Dad hooked it up $4,000. Like, the house appreciated. He had some money. So he's like, word. Here's a motorhome for you, kid. You spoil little shit. You and your hooligan friends go have fun. So, yeah, back to, you know, that drive up to Sea Otter in 07. I'm thinking, dude, this is the end of my road, man. Like, this Avent Bombshell thing is going under. Mm-hmm. Like, Mike King was technically my manager at that time.
And, yeah.
And I could tell the writing was on the wall that the Avent mountain bike division was going to die.
Yep.
So literally as I'm thinking this, bing, text from Scott Hart. Hey, dude, you should quit doing everything you're doing and come work for me.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Like, what does that look like? What does that pay look like? How does $1,500 every 2 weeks sound? Like, sign me up. It looks like I'm dropping out of college and I'm a bike industry journalist. Yeah.
And so that's for decline.
That was for in decline. 07. Yep. That was for decline. So we kind of worked on when I started. I started a decline in September of 07.
Okay.
Right. Cause like before that I was doing freelance. I was contributing words for the Junior Spotlight, mm-hmm. and then the Roots column.
Yep.
So every month I was talking about the future and the past of the sport.
Yep.
For riders. And yeah, so I took that and also like I asked Scott when he offered me the gig, I was like, hey dude, can I keep racing? Yeah, absolutely. Don't see why not.
Hmm.
I think our opinions of like what racing was were different, but anyway, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So yeah, that was the first time I really realized like, wow, this is crazy. I thought 1 minute, this is the end of the road. This is my last trip to Sea Otter. Yeah. To like, oh damn. Like I'm getting like a college graduate salary. I'm dropping out of college for it. And I'm going to go all over the world on other people's dimes. This is sick.
Yeah.
So my grandparents, another cool story. So my grandparents lived out their lives in Carmel, which is like just south of Monterey. Right. So every year we go to Sea Otter, it was hanging out with the grandparents.
Yeah, for sure.
So that Sea Otter of 07, another little side story. So exactly 1 year prior at Sea Otter 06,
mm-hmm.
at my grandparents' dinner table, my grandfather goes, Sean, when are you going to quit messing around with them bikes? You belong in the sky. He's a fighter pilot. Like I come from the lineage of pilots.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I didn't have an answer for him. Like, what do you
mean?
Was
it anything you ever wanted to do?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. When I was like 5 years old, I was kind of split in life. I sort of knew that I was going to be a pilot or some sort of like warrior or an athlete.
No way.
At five. I knew that's what I was going to do.
Huh.
So anyway, 06, Gramps was like, yeah, when are you going to quit messing around with bikes? Like, you're blowing it. You need to be in the sky. Then the next year, like, hey, Mac, I got a job. I'm gonna be a magazine editor. He knew exactly what that was.
Yeah.
He's like, well, yeah. I'm like, yeah. They're gonna send me the first thing I got to do. My first assignment is I got to go to Switzerland in June, 2 months from now. Oh yeah. Who's paying for that? Because you know my grandparents had to contribute a little bit to the Grizz Racing effort. Excuse me. So I'm going to Switzerland in June, Mac. And he goes, yeah, who's paying for it? I'm like, oh, this company called GT Bikes. He goes, well, hope you get some pussy. Oh my God. You can edit that out, but I got to say, like, he's so proud, dude. He went from instantly like, what are you doing with your life? To like, you're going to be a
you're legit now.
Published journalist, salary, world traveling. You made it. Holy crap.
Yeah.
I have no idea what you're doing, but you clearly know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty rad.
So that was pretty affirming, yeah. But so that 07 transition, I did some racing on a part-time effort. Actually raced like Sean Paris. So I did go to Switzerland for a product camp for GT Bikes.
Okay.
And lined up for that Sean Paris World Cup. It was one of four Americans. Duncan Riffle did us proud. He was the only one to qualify.
Yeah.
I think Garrett Batog, Cole Banger and myself were happy to not be racing finals that next day. That shit was gnarly.
Is it as gnarly as they say?
Oh, dude, I think it was gnarlier that first year.
Yeah.
I think it was the gnarliest.
Just because it was
fresh. But I could be wrong. I mean, there's no dirt on that track anymore, it looks like. It's just all rock.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I haven't ridden there since 07, so it could be worse now. But it was gnarly, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
So gnarly. Then, 2008, that was, you know, my first experience of like a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
Although that, you know, it wasn't like a 9-to-5 schedule, like you know, like what I do now. But, you know, you had
but the, yeah, then there were,
you worked a decline, you know the deal,
18 hour days. And then
there was 8 day work weeks where like you're sleeping on a couch in your office. And that's just kind of how it, we rolled, you went through that office. So,
okay. You were up in Valencia then.
So moved up north from San Diego to, worked in Valencia, but lived in Ventura. And that was a pretty magical era too. So like Clay Porter and Nate Riffle, we ended up all living on the same street, the Gonzaga Street. So I know everyone that's from Ventura that was there at that time is like smiling right now because it was just a magical era, man. We all just had a really, really good time and sincerely enjoyed each other's company.
Dude, that's sick.
You know, like outside of being knucklehead party animals, whatever, like it was just, it was magical, man. Yeah. Like your chosen family kind of environment. So
sweet.
And dude, my time in decline was so sick. That really opened the world for me in this industry. Man, I was like doing the networking thing before I really knew what networking was.
Yeah.
You know, and you get thrown into a position like that. Now you have to like network. That's your job. You got to know names and faces and make advertisers happy.
Sure.
And, I mean, dude, I'm 22 at this point, like 23.
You were that young.
I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, just, like writing, dude, it was
but you can talk, dude. That's half the battle. Like you're a personal dude. Like it doesn't matter how smart you are. Like if you're just cold and boring, who cares? No one wants to be around you.
I know.
I don't know what I'm trying to say. Like
there's a lot of PhD carrying fools out there that, that can put a fly to sleep. Yeah. I hear what you're saying.
So, what happened from there then? Because how long were there? 2 years? Three years?
Yeah, so it was just under 2 years.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something about the racing thing, like the different ideas.
Yeah. So I ended up racing a lot less than I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And as I kind of grew into the decline role, I kind of had this internal conflict of like...
Intruder alert.
That's all right. The hip locks up when I sit for too long.
Yeah, does it? Do you want to take a little break?
Nah, we'll roll around. Yeah, we'll keep it going. We'll keep it going. So, I was at decline. I guess, I was talking about the internal conflict of decline. This internal conflict I identified was that, like, man, I'm building these heroes of the sport of like, people that I can beat. Does that make sense? I'm like helping this guy get on the cover and I beat that guy. Oh, and I can beat that guy right now.
Yeah.
From this desk.
Dude, that's gnarly.
So I identified that I had this burning drive to race and I hadn't reached my potential, not even close.
Okay.
And until that point, I had never just raced mountain bikes full time. I'd always been working, going to school and racing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not really the formula for going far in racing. So anyway, long short of it, I was kind of just had my head cut off a decline and was given an opportunity to,
they let you go.
They let me go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a weird deal. I definitely collected unemployment insurance. So that kind of tells you whatever that says, like I was wrongfully terminated, we could say.
Yeah.
I saw like, well, when I got let go from decline, I was instantly crushed because I loved living in Ventura. I loved the people and still love those people in Ventura.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really want to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I applied for a job at Giant Bikes.
Yeah.
And
Thousand Oaks.
Yeah. And TO. Yeah. Yeah. And that didn't work out for the better. Cause I think the guy that actually got the position I interviewed for is still with the company.
Oh,
so
cool.
I think that definitely worked out better for Giant.
Yeah.
Smart move, guys. So when I realized like, man, I got to pack up shop cause there's really nothing for me up in Ventura. Mm-hmm. Like I was like, dude, I'm 24 now. If I don't go racing now, I'm never going to do it. I'm not getting any younger and I got to just do this now. So I pretty much just moved my belongings back to my parents' garage and hit the road. Went out and it kind of went underground. Like I think I did just a couple like cash jobs, you know, to scrounge up some funds to go racing. Like I put on Clay's movie premiere, whatever the film was in 2009 in Monterey.
Mm-hmm.
Did like independent contract job for Giant and then had that unemployment rolling in. So went right, and this is 2009.
Okay.
Made a first appearance at a Fontana race, was around that top 10 bubble. So I knew my fitness was on par, mm-hmm. like to, for everywhere else in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the first time I really like kind of like turned up again was like, oh, Chris won a Gravity East race out of Massanutten, Virginia.
No, I really? You went out there?
Yeah. Drove across the country and yeah. Yeah. So I was sort of living what I was kind of preaching or trying to preach at my time of decline, where I had this vision of American gravity racing being split like Supercross lights. Mm-hmm. You have an East and West.
Sure.
There's a bunch of us scrubs who can't afford this transcontinental travel. So why not split it up? Have a series on the West, a series on the East, and then have
a finale.
And then grant the USA National Championships, right. Like Grand Nationals, whatever you want to call it. Like at the old Decline Symposium in 08, I pitched that to these industry influencers or whatever.
Yeah.
Again, not knowing, just being naive and like, well, you know, like, I guess I got to talk about something, so I'm going to talk about racing and how I think it should be.
Sick. I want to hear that.
And they're wanting to talk about dropper posts and like, yeah. You know, this is... If I would have said the word 650B back then, I would have been prophetic. But I wanted to talk about racing.
East West shootout.
This is let's shoot it out. Yep. So me setting out on the road and going to Gravity East was really just me living my words.
Hmm.
Like, yeah, I'm gonna be this West Coast guy. I'm gonna come over and smack you upside the face, East Coast, Tupac and Biggie style. but in good sport. And so yeah, I did. Went out, won a Gravity East race. Narrowly beat Nico Mullally and really proud of myself for how I handled the microphone that day, because it was like full Talladega Night style, you know, like I got to the bottom of my race run gassed, you know, winded, and I'm just like, by the time I got my breath, I'm like, yeah, so who's doing what? And someone's like, well, Grizz, you're in the lead. I'm like, really? Sick. but this is Decline Team America era too. Mm-hmm. So it felt really good. Like, oh yeah, Decline, you wanna do that to me? Well, I just beat your boy.
Get some revenge out of there.
Yep. So but anyway, like I was definitely aware of building up Nico Mullally, and I knew Nico was gonna be, you know, one of the guys for American Downhill in the future. So anyway, like I ended up winning the race, and when it was, you know, they give you the mic to like say your whatever, I just talked about Nico. It was just like, look, dude, this is the guy, whatever. I'm old news. Like 10 years from now, Nico's going to be making it's all proud. And like, I was really, really pumped on how I handled that.
Yeah, nice.
Nico is the guy. Yep. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, and he is.
He is, dude. Nico's this, like, probably the sickest thing for American Downhill right now.
Yeah.
What do you think? And I love you, Gwen, but I mean, dude, come on. Gwen's not building Windrock. You know, he's building a mansion.
Yeah.
It's good for Gwen. He should.
Yep. But you appreciate what Nico's doing with,
I've appreciated the Mullallys since day one. Mm-hmm. You know, hearing Scott Hart talk so fondly about the Mullallys, I was like, dude, this family's sick. Like, I wish that like I was had a family like the Mullallys. You know, like my dad was like just, you know, into it as much as I was, or whatever. But so that 2009. Started off pretty good. I won that Gravity East race, my one and only pro downhill victory. And
you got one though.
I got one. I got one. Yeah, that's it. Never quit, kids. Never quit. Every now and again, you get lucky. and I contended more Gravity East racing. Did I think a Mountain Creek local race. Did U.S. Open. And then, so I was on the East Coast for like a month and a half, okay. Stayed with the Memelar family up in New York.
Yeah.
And came back to SoCal, regrouped, hit some I hit like a Northwest Cup up at Mount Hood.
Mm-hmm.
And that year, Ryan Kondrashoff got hurt at U.S. Open.
Okay.
So he was on the X-Fusion Intense team, with Karen Bennett and that. And so like with Teo, the filmer. Uh-huh. So.
Was JD on that too at that time?
No, this is before that.
Okay.
So this is, the year prior to that.
Okay.
So I get a call from John Hauer, who at the time was the marketing guy at X-Fusion USA.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, Grizz, hey, dude, you're riding pretty good this year. We got a bike and a spot on the team open. If you want to take it, we'll go to US Champs, US National Champs, race a couple World Cups and Crankworks. And I was like... This year's getting better and better. Right. I started off weird. I thought like my life was over losing this career job, but this is sick.
Yeah, keeps bringing you back in.
Yeah, keeps bringing me back in. So yeah, that finished off 09 on the Exvision Intense team, racing with Kieran Bennett from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And we did, U.S. National Champs, or I did U.S. National Champs. Started at Mount St. Anne, started at Bromont, the two World Cups in Quebec. Yeah. I say start because obviously I didn't qualify. State of affairs. My final, just for the record, I crossed the line on my final, my last World Cup start, across the line in 81st.
Oh, first loser? Seriously?
The first loser, dude. Just the biggest kick to the nuts.
Oh,
the biggest.
Goodness.
And I think about it, I take myself back to that moment, it still hurts.
Does it?
God, it hurts.
I bet, yeah.
Because, dude, my splits were all rad, dude. I went from getting waxed at Mount St. Anne to the next weekend. Like, I'm in the mix, man. My split one, like, in the 50s. Split two, in the 50s. Split three, in the 60s. I botched one turn. And I dropped 20-something spots, man.
But Bromont was short, right? Like,
yeah, Bromont
2 minutes
was a sprint
or something?
Track. The gap from first to 80th was like 16 seconds.
Yeah.
So I was like 16.002 or whatever, you know?
Oh, back, man. And that's rough.
Yeah, it was rough. But it was all good, dude. I exceeded my expectations, man. Like, when I first set off to race downhill, I was going to be a Norba national guy. I was going to be a national guy. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I grew up when the Norbas were at one point bigger than World Cups.
Right.
So for the Norbas to die out and the World Cups to take over, and for me to, like, hey, dude, I've qualified for one World Cup in my life, that exceeds my expectations and goals. You know what I mean? I'm pumped on that, for as lame as it sounds.
No way. That's sick.
Dude, hey, have you qualified for a World Cup? Crickets. A lot of people haven't.
Oh, so many haven't. Yeah. Huh. Dude, that's rad.
Yeah, so.
Okay, and so that's 09?
Yeah, that's 09. So rounded out the season there. Then, so basically that Exfusion Intense program wasn't dissolving. It was just changing.
Okay.
So Exfusion was going to back down their financial commitment to a race team, but they still wanted an effort out there. And so Ron Kondrashoff was the guy. So we decided to form like Voltron. So Ryan Kondrashoff, JD Swangen, Brad Owen, and myself all came together and decided, hey, let's just take the reins of this race team and bring our partners, the partnerships that we do have, good relationships. Let's bring these together. So that in 2010, we formed the ODI Exfusion race team.
Okay.
Which was, again, like an amazing opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think we were all very, very proud of what we did. I mean, dude, that race team's been dead for 8 years and is still talked about.
Hmm.
You know, that says something.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And was it an equal effort between everyone, or was it like you and Ryan spearheading the admin kind of side of it, or like?
It was definitely an equal effort, and we all kind of utilized our strengths.
Okay.
So, and what I mean by that is, yeah, like Ryan owned the business. So he I think his chick at the time, like her dad was a lawyer.
Okay.
So he had access to just, you know, all kinds of knowledge and business knowledge, like to learn on the fly. So yeah, Ryan technically like owned everything and, you know, was responsible for the money and all this and that.
Yep.
But we came together and, like, you know, I think JD and I went up and did the pitch to ODI, to the team.
Okay.
And we got that, secured funding. We all kind of had a relationship with Intense. So, that was kind of like a natural alignment.
Yep.
And then we did independent gear sponsors, which I think at that time was something relatively new. I don't think teams were, you know, cause if you were on a team, like,
yeah, it was all pretty cohesive.
Yeah. It was like, you either were Fox or Royal or Troy Lee or whatever, you know? It was very rare to have like a syndicate style team now where you've got a team and these team sponsors, but there's autonomy in like a goggle sponsor or a gear sponsor or whatever, you know, back then it was just like, I think, if you were on a team, you had autonomy for maybe eyewear, you know? So, again, we set out to go racing nationally with select World Cup events. I think there was pretty much Wyndham and Mount St. Anne would have been the only two World Cups that we had on the schedule.
Yep.
But the kind of mission statement for that team was just defibrillate. Is that the right word for the shockers for the heart? American downhill racing, like shock the heart of American downhill racing and just bring this high intensity, fun energy and just promote downhill mountain biking as this super rad, fun, gnarly sport with cool people.
Yeah.
You know, and you can have freedom to be yourself, but there's a healthy lifestyle that comes with it because it's super competitive and getting more and more competitive. You know, obviously Gwen entered the, Gwen was crushing fools already.
Yep.
And kind of doing the Carmichael effect to downhill racing. But, and then too, we were all filming with Teo. So we were doing the all out thing at that time.
Yep.
So we were like, with these team edits, they've got to have flavor. Teo's not, we can't afford to bring T on board. And Teo was getting married and, you know, moving on with his life and stuff like that, kind of just growing up. So, but we wanted to keep that spirit and that passion alive.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing which kind of crushes me that it never happened, but we wanted the ODI Xfusion, that race team platform to be a lily pad for like the next Nico Mullally.
Okay.
You know, so we wanted to have this team that had like a long-term direction where you've got these mentors, whether it's JD or Ryan or myself or Brad or whoever, there's going to be some seasoned veteran on the team that's going to coach the up and coming talent, not only on racing, but like be a personality, like be marketable, like be yourself, be funny, be whatever,
be a
like,
human.
Be a human. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just don't be a robot.
Yeah.
And that unfortunately that never fell through because, you know, obviously things came traumatically crashing down. we had a lot of fun. That's for sure.
Yeah. And I remember it. And it was like the heyday of web videos and team edits from races. And yeah, it was always, everyone looked forward to those.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they still do.
Mm-hmm.
It's missing. I get blown away when people, you know, just talking in person at like Sea Otter or something like that, or now that I manage the Fresh Blood Grassroots team at Deity, I've got riders from that have hit me up going like, dude, I loved watching your jumps in Pine Valley. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
Wow, dude, that actually reached people. Holy crap.
Dude, that's a whole thing I want to talk about. And like, we're getting in, but like, dude, Pine Valley, like world-class jumps.
Yeah.
Every freaking stomper in the off season is coming to your jumps.
Pine Valley is photos. Still filmed once a year. It is Fast House Mountain Bike Division right now. You look at all their web banners, it's Pine Valley. And
it's like, where did that come from? Like, it was up the street. Like, you just started digging jumps. Like, talk about some of the
transformation of all that.
Like,
yeah, we're skipping, but we'll go back to. So the Pine Valley jumps, the Top Rocky Pass, and many of you have been there. That hill has always been popular for sledding when it does snow in Pine Valley.
Oh, really?
So that's how you kind of knew about that little zone.
Yeah.
But, obviously growing up in Southern California in the 90s and 2000s, you're surrounded by BMX, skateboarding, and motocross and surfing. But like, to me, skateboarding, BMX, and motocross I was a huge fan of all of those sports.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Krusty Demons videos and all that stuff, that exposed me to like, oh, that's what my friends are doing on the weekends when they go down to the desert, is they're jumping huge stuff.
Sand dunes, yeah.
So I just saw that there's that, the scrub roller at Pine Valley, like to me, oh, that looks like a sand dune. So if there's a landing, I can see a landing. You can jump this a couple different directions.
Yeah.
I'm gonna put a lip right here. And then I'm gonna put a lip right there. And so that little valley in Pine Valley is just the most ideal terrain for mountain bike.
It's such
jumps.
A neat spot.
It's so neat. I've never found anything else like it in the world. And I've looked hard.
Yeah.
That place is perfect. So going back, I touched on like how racing at Snow Summit intimidated me back in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
A part of what intimidated me was watching the Norba National at Big Bear. There was jumbo jumps.
Mm.
And I'm like, dude, I don't have 40-foot booters to hit. Well, I got a zone over here and that hill are about 40 feet apart. So it looks like I need to gap that. And that's literally how it started. It was definitely influenced by the Krusty videos.
Yeah.
Those guys jumping natural terrain things on dirt bikes. And
just needing to jump for racing
and needing to be comfortable with jumping big stuff. And the older I got, the bigger the jumps needed to get. And
when did it blow up? Like, it seemed like there was like Sam Hill on Iron Horse, like when, was it Nowak, is that his name,
Nowak. Yeah, Nowak and Alex Rankin came out and did a shoot with the Mad Catz Iron Horse guys.
Oh, so before that.
So,
okay.
So yeah, so like I was still in high school, actually, when like people started showing up to the jumps.
Like how'd they find out about it?
Dude.
Because they're yours, right? Like you started it there.
I don't think that people found out about it because they were like mine per se. I think like Nowak and those guys knew about the jumps from my friend Troy.
Okay.
So my friend Troy, a lot of you guys know Troy. He's like a mythical creature, underground downhill guy from San Diego. Okay. Like Anderson Truck Trail OG.
Okay.
I think Troy tipped a lot of people off, like the heavy hitters, because when the big sticks would come to town, Troy would go and ride with like Ben Corey and, you know, the Aussies, when because they were all like in El Cajon or whatever.
Okay.
They would stay down in El Cajon.
Okay.
So I think they found out through maybe Troy, but most of the general public found out about my jumps from my freaking mom at the Pine Valley store, right?
No
so if you
way.
Would go and ride Noble Canyon, typically you go to the Pine Valley store to get your pizza and brownie and Mountain Dew or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you'd have this like long haired hippie lady going, "Hey, do you like to jump your bike? My son's got some great jumps up the road." And I'd be like, "Mom, stop telling people. You're blowing it for me, Mom."
Yeah. No way. And then so it just started to get
Get more and more traction. The word of mouth thing went out. But then within our community, like when that Iron Horse Mad Catz team segment came out in Earth 2, that's when Pine Valley, like there were some jumps that were like looked pretty sick.
Yeah.
You know, the Aussies definitely made it look sick.
Okay. So they were building out there, or was it just that they were riding them?
Well, they were just riding.
Okay.
So they were riding, but what I learned from the Aussies was that they would, what I liked about what those guys would do is they would do like these little cutty lines into jumps.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, that's sick.
Huh.
Like, yeah, dude, that makes this rhythm way harder if you have to slap four ruts to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of helped me like develop some skill just watching those guys play around on bikes, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much like myself and a handful of other people have done 100% of the building out there.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll get to where we were with X-Fusion and all that stuff, but via Pine Valley, is that where Side Flight idea came from?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So the Side Flight, like the best whip concept, again, that came from BMX and motocross.
Sure.
Right? The sports were already doing best whips. So, in 2009, with the support of X-Fusion Intense, again, and John Hauer, we talked about doing something unique, something cool. Like, hey, dude, mountain biking needs best whip. Like, the time is now. There's a bunch of nasty riders, you know, like Vanderham. Dude, Vanderham was throwing down at that time.
Yeah.
You know, and like really, really intriguing people with just whips, you know, and style. Mm-hmm. So, originally the Side Flight contest was supposed to be held at the jumps in Pine Valley. Against my will, actually, I told Howard, I'm like, dude, we can't do it at Pine Valley. Like, the Forest Service is going to shut this down faster than we get it off the ground.
Like, it was underground enough for people to show up and ride, but this would have blown it up too much.
Yeah. So, for the record, the Pine Valley jumps are 100% illegal. But I think they've been there for long enough. It's been 2 decades. They've been there for 20 years now. So, they might be like grandfathered in.
Yeah. Grandpa Grizz.
The concept for a best whip contest in mountain biking came, and then the Pine Valley jumps are just perfect for it. You know, what we dub the Natapult now, like the big booter up over the hill, it's like 45-foot gap. That jump is perfect for whips and flips and whatever you want to throw on it. But so that was the concept. Like, we do it there. And I think John even like did like a PR about it, you know, like best whip, Pine Valley.
Yeah, remember.
And Forest Service hit him up like within 10, 12 hours.
Really?
And I was like, Howard, I told you, dude, I told you we couldn't do it at the jumps. So literally the contest went from not happening to happening in 24 hours. I found an alternate venue, which was that old motocross track, which became 212 land. It's now gone. But was last known as 212 land on Indian reservation. I think it's on the Manzanita Res. So you don't have, dude, old Smokey the Bear doesn't have law out there on the sovereign nation.
Here's
so
a tractor. Go have
so
fun.
Approached this guy, Ben, who was managing the track at that time. I was like, hey man, got $2,500. You got a zone and equipment. Can we make this happen?
Huh.
He's like, well, I ain't too good at math and accounting, so yeah, it sounds like a good plan. So we made Side Flight happen on $2,500 in 24 hours.
Yeah.
And so yeah, went out there and just found the zone and like, all right, Ben, push dirt here, push dirt there, push dirt here, push dirt there. And we'll come in with shovels and do the rest.
Yeah, and it was sick. It was big.
So
tell me about the weekend, like, because the finals got winded out, right? That was the tough spot.
But the practice day. Yeah, the practice day, I think the practice day of Side Flight was Fest Series before Fest Series.
Yeah, for sure.
I think a lot of the riders enjoyed just the atmosphere of that, of like, dude, this is completely for fun.
Yep.
There's no pressure. Like, it's just all bros having a good time and just, you know, friendly competition, just pushing each other. So, not that I'm claiming Fest Series by any means, but I think that just that kind of loose, friendly environment was like a breath of fresh air for everybody.
Around a massive jump that was sick.
Yeah. It was sick rhythm. Yeah. So, the practice day was really, really fun, man. To have Brendan and Fairclough show up, have Brendan and Vanderham show up.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, dude, this is sick.
Yeah,
got these heavy hitters. Like, it's awesome having Straight here, but he's my bro. He better be here.
Right? Yeah.
Not to take anything away from you, Kyle. I still love you, but these dudes were international, you know? That was just so much fun. I just remember having like the best time. That was literally, that weekend was probably two, three of the funnest days I've ever had riding my bike ever.
Yeah. You had the sickest whips, at least in the one video.
I whipped my whips.
They were weird. They were different than everyone else's for sure.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So touching on that, Cody Warren and I had actually been talking about how you could whip a downhill bike better than it was being done. That step up that I was cracking those whips on, Cody and I talked all the way through about like how that lip needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the magic of a good whip jump is in the belly of the jump. That's where all the magic happens, is, you know, two bike lengths before you take off the thing.
Okay.
So I like studied Kevin Windham and Justin Barsha on their motos and figured out what they were doing and how they were loading up the suspension and all this and that, and like the body English and things.
Oh, really?
I'm like, dude, we can do this. Like Cody and I kind of like talked it through, like it can be done, but it is super weird without a motor.
Mm.
And, they started that practice day. Like, those whips started to come around. I was taking off far right corner, probably 3 to 4 feet farther right than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And like, my tires were sliding off that lip, both front and back. Like, it was pretty scary actually to not have a motor to bring it back around.
Uh-huh.
Like, I think one of them, my pants got stuck in my seat and I had to like just bone, like, yank a bar. Yeah. Like just, yeah, whoa. But, I remember Ryan Howard giving me props on when I cracked one whip, and he was just like, Grizz, dude, you're seriously freaking inspiring me right now. Dude, these are so dirty. I'm like, that is a compliment.
And then
Clay Porter later that evening was like, yeah, dude, Vanderham and Brendan and I show up and you cracked the dirtiest whip, dude. All three of our jaws nearly hit the floor. And I was like, yeah,
found it, dude.
sick
dude.
But I think that weekend successfully changed whips on downhill bikes forever.
Yeah, because what happened next, like that next summer?
Yeah, that next summer it's at Crankworks. Sven took the lead, and good on you, Sven. It needed to be done.
Yeah,
I mean, best whip at Crankworks is the sickest event of, like, it's the sickest. It's sicker than Mount St. Anne downhill finals.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd go that far, but it's pretty.
Yeah, close. Maybe that's a little far, but
it still is. Yeah.
That's pretty much the best whip. And yeah, it's just a bummer that the wind didn't pan out and I wasn't able to like fully prove the point that I had the dirtiest whip that day. But but hey, dude, the riders spoke. Like, I wasn't a judge that day.
Yeah.
Everyone said I was the guy. So. Yeah. Still got the plaque out here to prove it. I got you, Brendan. You too, Vanderham. What's up?
We'll post the video in the notes. It's still up there. So, all right, let's get back to kind of where we were and a big jump that didn't go so well.
Yeah. So we kind of touched on
this one. Sucks. Like, I've been thinking about yeah, just thinking about seeing you in the hospital and like that you're the one that's messed up. And I'm like, oh, it messed me up. But just...
It messed a lot of people up, man.
Dude. So, okay. Yeah. Let's get into it.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess we'll talk about the fateful day. You know what some spiteful stuff is, dude? You know what the name of that jump was? It was Negrodamus.
Is that what that one was?
The name of that jump was Negrodamus.
Because, yeah, everything was named after Chappelle's show.
Yeah, which is hilarious. Yeah. But I was like, yeah, man, I got a limp because I overshot a jump called Negrodamus.
Oh, man.
So yeah, we touched on me, yeah. Like, I was, in 2010, I was in a state of mind where I 100% committed my life to racing downhill. I mean, that's what I was doing for the first time in my life. All I was doing was racing downhill. It was essentially like in my dream world. Mm-hmm. I made it. So I wanted to protect that. I mean, I was willing to risk my life for it, you know? So I was definitely racing with that high level of like, I will die trying to win intensity. Mm. Probably not the best state of mind. Maybe a little bit more intense for what you can ultimately get out of this sport. Mm. But that's how I roll, man. I definitely like once you have support like that, I don't know about you, but for me, I was willing to do whatever it took to keep that and keep progressing. So going into national championships in 2010, we had been struggling to get results that we ultimately needed to keep the dream alive. And there was a little bit of other like excess tension. Like Brad was pretty over it. And I think Ryan was kind of getting over the downhill racing thing too, you know, cause it was getting really dangerous.
Yep.
And the risk reward factor was, yeah, starting to not make a lot of sense for most people. Sure. So, but for JD and I, we were like, dude, we are committed. Like this is, we got to do this, you know? So yeah, going into national champs, a couple things were going on. One, we needed a big result. Two, I was also trying to get into Rampage that year.
Right? Wow, really? To ride Rampage?
Yeah, to ride Rampage in 2010.
Huh. Yeah.
And so, like, because after the, you know, the best whip down the side flights and all that stuff in San Diego and Pine Valley, and, you know, I got to ride with, like, G. Atherton. The Athertons a lot. They would always come out to Pine Valley.
Yeah.
You know, the Athertons and a few other riders were like, Grizz, you should really do Rampage. You know, because they... And in hindsight, like it would have been a brilliant idea. You know, you take like a mid pack racer for, you know, whatever. I wasn't, you know, yeah, I was a mid pack guy, I guess, you know, a little bit closer to the front than mid, but whatever. So for like a struggling racer, it makes a lot of sense to be visible, and how much more visible can you be as a mountain biker than Rampage?
Yeah, for sure.
And plus all these heavy hitters were like, hey, we got confidence. You can ride it. You should do it. So I was like, yeah, if you believe in me, I believe in me. I got this. I mean, I'm not going to flip anything, but yeah, like I'll at least make it look good.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, going into that national champs week, I was going back and forth with Todd Barber, and he was basically like, look, we need, you know, you need a letter of recommendation. It's like, cool. Got that dialed.
Yeah.
I just need to see your resume. I'm like, resume, like results. All right, let me just get you a national title real quick. That was literally, in my head, that's what I'm thinking. I'm like, dude, you're not going to be psyched on like a 23rd at Sea Otter or like 20th over here in Plattekill or whatever I ended up. You know what I mean? Like, oh, this guy hits the deck and like finishes somewhere mid-pack in a downhill race. Like, is this really what we want at Rampage? So I was like, yeah, let me just get you a title real quick. So, yeah, man, I really, really, really like wanted to perform and get a big result.
No way. I didn't realize that was in the back of your head.
A lot of pressure. Yeah. I put a lot of pressure on myself. Plus, dude, Vital put me on as a contender. So I'm like, yeah,
let's make this legit.
You want to believe in me? I'm gonna do you solid here. So yeah, that was definitely kind of like a all or nothing weekend. Hmm. I've never approached a race like that. And yeah, I'm glad I didn't because it didn't work out for me. But, you know, with that Sol Vista track, it was really short. And I knew that there was, you know, like I was never one of those racers that ever had a perfect run. Mm-hmm. My race runs were always just very rough around the edges, in my opinion. So I thought like, okay, where can I make up time? And I looked at that jump, Nigrodamus. I'm like, there's a lot of landing pad. And I think I can go about 65 feet out on that thing, catch the very last little bit of transition. And that's going to rocket me out of those woods. And yeah, maybe that'll give me the 8 seconds I need to make up, or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And my biggest mistake with that decision was that I didn't practice that jump at the speed that I raced it ever. I brake checked. And man, yeah, that Nigrodamus jump, like, you pretty much had to brake check it to not get bucked, right? So, but other racers had figured that out. They had hit it with a little bit too much speed and like felt the nose dip and realized like, oh, you have to brake check for this jump.
Mm-hmm.
My dumb ass was like, nope, just brain in the bucket. Mm-hmm. I'm committing to this run. No one else is going to do this. This is what's going to set me apart. This is what's going to get me up towards the top of that box. And dude, you remember the weather that day? The storm was coming in.
Yeah, super Colorado windy, months. Right?
Yeah, super windy. Some riders got a crosswind. Some riders got a headwind. I got a tailwind, which is, you know.
Yeah, when you're already not going to brake check and then you get a push.
Yeah, so I'll just walk you through like the last moments from my perspective. So there was a right-hand turn that led you into that jump.
Yeah.
Right-hand turn into a long straightaway into that jump. And I remember like when I was in the apex of that right-hander, I was staring so far ahead. I was already looking at the jump. I'm like, okay, yeah, good. I'm like looking ahead. So I'm carrying good speed here. The thought crossed my head, but I didn't listen. I'm like, no, I'm not brake checking. I'm committing to this.
Dude.
And as soon as I took off of that jump, like nose dipped, I just felt like I got, you know, kicked in the ass. Just doing. My last conscious thought was, oh shit, I'm dead. Go with it. I literally, like, that was it. I just accepted death. I literally thought I was dead.
No way.
I thought that was, instincts was just like, you're dead, roll with it. And dude, that saved my life.
Just because it kind of kept you limp, like just relaxed, I guess?
Yeah, yeah. So I naturally like shrugged, which is like anyone, like a boxer. This is like what you do as a human to protect yourself from impact is lift your shoulders up, you know, like dig your chin into your neck. That'll protect you from a lot. I mean, that's how you're technically supposed to take a punch or whatever.
Okay.
So the first thing that hit was my head. And dude, I got the helmet in the garage. I couldn't have kissed the ground any softer with my head. Like I have like no real scratches. I mean, I couldn't, it was just barely gray. So I saved my head instantly.
So you head first, or you're like kind of like half front somersault sort of position?
Yeah, about half front somersault. Clipped the head, my left collarbone snaps in half. That was the first thing that broke. And then I'm clipped in. So my bike catapults around, accelerates my legs. And I basically just drove my heels into the ground, which then pushed my legs, my femurs through my pelvis.
God.
So,
both of them.
Yeah. Both femurs just blew up my, hip sockets. So the acetabulum, people, I've heard that I was never unconscious from people that were there, but I was definitely unconscious.
Yeah.
From, you know, blacked out, shock, whatever it was. Yep. But when I came to, the pain was unbearable.
Yeah.
Gnarly, just cramps, just massive, massive cramps. Mm. It felt like the worst locking cramp, and I couldn't move my legs.
Yeah.
My right leg was noticeably shorter than my left.
Like you're conscious of that? Like you could see it?
Yeah, I couldn't move it, but could see like, oh my God, my right foot is like in my shin. Foot was like 6 inches shorter than my left. Up. Yeah.
And where was the pain in your hips, like your legs, your torso?
Like, yeah, like all of it.
Like the cramping, I mean.
Yeah, the cramping was definitely throughout the legs, throughout, you know, glutes, torso, guts, you know what I mean? Just everything was just like contracting. It was trauma response. And I remember like, I can't remember if I was in the like the medical tent or whatever. I think I was on site when they were like loading me up onto the backboard. I was trying to convince them to just let me walk it off.
Are you serious? Oh man.
Yeah. It's like, dude, but like, it was like my own shock and disbelief, you know, their brain's like, no, this isn't happening. You're not paralyzed. No. Just give it 5 minutes. You'll walk it off. You'll be cool. No, not cool. And just like I vaguely remember looking up and seeing people's faces and saw just like ghost white, like friends are crying and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, this is not good.
Yeah.
This is how, holy crap. Like this is happening. This is happening. Oh my God, dude, what does this mean? And, yeah, I was just kind of in and out of consciousness as you were. I don't know if they, how soon they hit me on the morphine, but, mm-hmm. You know, the helicopter airlift ride from Sol Vista down to St. Anthony's in Denver was in and out of consciousness.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, this is like apocalypse now. I feel like I'm in a Vietnam war movie right now or something like that, bet, like, on the chopper. Yeah. Literally, like, dude, the morphine and that kind of shock, my brain was just going all over the place.
I'm sure.
One moment I'm like, well, this is, I've always wanted to fly in a helicopter, but sucks. It's got to be like this. Yeah. You know, like literally think stuff like that. And then, yeah, dude, getting and like, yeah, that level of trauma, it's gnarly. Like it was straight up movie scene style. You know, I landed on the top of the building. They get me out of the helicopter. Like this army of staff is there to unload you and bring you into the, like this ICU or whatever it is. And they stop.
You're like conscious enough to remember that.
Yeah. Definitely like in a sedated state, but I remember it.
Are you feeling anything like just that it's out of whack or is it at least like, are you just kind of out of it?
I could definitely feel that stuff was really, really wrong.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you it was my pelvis that I broke. I didn't know if it was my back, my hips, my femurs. Like I had no idea. I just knew that my lower half of my body wasn't working.
Yep.
And the pain was unlike anything.
Even on the drugs.
Even on the drugs. Like there was no drug strong enough to help with that pain.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was heavy. And like, dude, you have to be sort of sharp in that situation, because they extract a bunch of information out of you. You need to know your social security number. You need to know phone numbers so that they can contact people. And so in my case, you know, I gave them information, gave them my social security number, gave them my parents' contact information, phone numbers. And then I had to get them in contact with, you know, Ryan and JD and Brad. And I didn't remember any of those numbers by heart, but I did remember JD's family home number.
No way. Just from being a kid.
Yeah. Just from being a kid, you know, it's 619, blah, 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 blah. So they got a hold of JD by his parents first. So, right. Like the shockwave just got unintentionally gnarlier.
Yeah. You know?
And it was just brutal. But, I was pretty like in the thick of it in that whole trauma, you know, incident. I was just like, dude, the human brain is a magical thing. I couldn't remember that phone number today if I wanted to. I can remember the first six digits, but you know, the last four, like, I was just really, really blown away with like how your brain is there when you absolutely need it in ways that you could never. I don't know. It was just eye opening, man.
Yeah,
it was really, really eye opening. But yeah, that was a lonely first night, you know, I was there solo and man, I didn't know if I was going to live, I was going to die. I had no idea what was going on. I just remember making a couple good decisions. One was, so the first thing they had to do was put traction. So they had to drive a pin through my right leg with the tib fib and then hang a bunch of weight to help reset my dislocated right hip, which I needed surgically reset.
Okay.
So I asked him like, okay, so when you put this traction deal on my leg, like, are you guys going to knock me out? Yeah. We're going to put you under. I'm like, hey, are you guys going to give me a catheter thing too? Yeah. We're going to give you a catheter. Okay. Wait until I'm unconscious to put the catheter. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, it's why not?
Decisions like that. Like,
yeah,
if you ever find yourself messed up, just try to calm down and just let your brain take over and be smart.
Yeah. Minimize the, yeah, the minimize bad the, stuff coming, right?
Yeah. Damage control.
Dude.
And I woke up the next day, like Frankenpin in my leg. I think you guys were there that next day.
I was
heavily sedated and was kind of getting.
It was so hard to see you like that. Like,
yeah.
I've never really been around something like that. I don't know if a lot of people have, but just especially knowing it was you too. It's just,
yeah, yes. That was a heavy deal, man. I for two parts, because it like for me, I don't want to make anybody bummed out, especially those that I like and that are close to me.
Yeah.
Like I'm here to make people smile ideally. Mm. You know what I mean? Like that's just something like an energy I've always enjoyed sharing is like laughter. So to have like all you guys and girls there, like, you know, the racing family just so long in the face, you know what I mean? Mm. I could see everyone's like just torture, you know, it looked like people were tortured looking at me.
Yeah. And that's it, interesting that like you're looking at it as like, I don't want you to be bummed out because of me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. Even I did. Though you're destroyed. I was bummed that I was bumming you guys all out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I felt like that love and that connection mm. and felt that like, holy crap, there's so many people in this sport that really, really care about me.
Mm.
And that still just means I can't even put into words what that means, mm. you know, but, definitely seeing a lot of you guys there. I carried that with me through recovery and to this day, you know, hopefully how I've ended up and will continue to carry on with life makes you guys all proud and like, you know, happy that things got better, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Like what was the recovery process like? And like, kind of what did you learn in that process?
Dude. I learned a lot, man.
It took a while, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. So recovery was, so I took two surgeries to get me back together. And then once I got put back together, the Western medicine gave me no guarantees. There was no guarantees that I would ever walk again, ride again, function, you know, they didn't know. My right leg was so what happened with my right leg was my femur essentially pierced through the pelvis.
Okay.
And the head of the femur, that the part of the femur that the ball that joint, sits yep. in the cup. So that tagged my sciatic nerve and compressed it, pinched it. So the surgeon said that when they reset the hip, that there was this perfect like concave shape of the femur in my nerve, the sciatic nerve. Now, if that nerve was severed, they would have amputated my leg.
Oh.
But that's just a crazy thing about nerves, man. Like they classified as a contusion. So a bruised nerve completely shut off. I think they call it neurotransmission. So I couldn't feel or move my right leg. I had like maybe 1 or 2 millimeters movement out of like one toe on my right leg.
Hmm.
And today, 8 years later, it's my lead leg. It's now doing the bulk of the work for me, just moving around.
Interesting.
Riding, like walking and stuff like that, for yeah. sure. Like when I stand up off this chair, I'm gonna favor on my right leg now.
Okay.
But so starting with a nerve injury where you have very minimal feeling and very minimal motor use of the limb, it's going to be a naturally slow process.
Mm-hmm.
So, and with no real, like the Western medicine doctors didn't really have like an outline rehab protocol for me. You know, they were yeah. like, we've never really been down this road and we don't know what to do. So
like, was that at the hospital in Denver, or was that just kind of anyone you talked to?
More in San Diego. So in Denver, so St. Anthony's put me back together, stabilized me. And okay. then I was discharged to a rehab center over in Aurora. So the Spalding Rehab Center.
Yeah.
And so Spalding was really step one in recovery. So there they educated me on how to basically be living out of a wheelchair, handicapped,
wow.
crippled. You know, this is how you live out of a wheelchair. This is how you slide from your chair to a toilet. This is how you slide from your chair to a car. And you have to go through all of these hoops to get discharged from the rehab center. I was out of there, I think, in 4 days.
Okay.
Which is insane.
Quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw in that rehab center, I just saw death and decay around me. And I was like, I have to get out of here as fast as I possibly can.
Uh-huh.
Or I'm not going to make it, you know, like,
cause you feel like at that point it was your mental state. Like you're either totally. Like, I'm going to get over this or I'm just going to wither away.
Yeah. Yeah. I just couldn't be surrounded by that energy, that like the, whatever you want to call it, dude, yeah. purgatory or whatever. Like it was crazy. So I did everything I could to get out of there as fast as I could. And I mean, the whole staff there was just blown away with what they saw in my progress. I mean, dude, like it took me 20 minutes to get from my wheelchair to like my mom's car. That's like how painful it was. But it's like, if I don't do this now, I basically have to do this.
Yeah.
I'm going to grimace through this pain, because if I don't do it now, then I have to try again tomorrow. If I don't do it tomorrow, then I have to try again the day after. I need to get out of here as fast as I can. So I'm just going to suck it up, make these crunchy bones move, and get in this damn car, get me out of this rehab center. Which I think ultimately what I learned through the course of recovery is that your mindset is everything. Mm-hmm. You really have to control your mindset and state of mind. And it boils down to 100% accountability. Mm-hmm. If you're not responsible for yourself, no one else is. And if you don't want to get better, no one else cares.
Yeah.
And no one's going to make you better for you. You have to own it and just get through it. Mm-hmm. So I was, once I was discharged from Aurora, I then spent a night in a hospital in San Diego, and they just needed to do, you know, blood work and make sure I was stable to go home. And so when I was out of the hospital, you know, I was going, you know, I had to go back for, I think, like weekly checkups or something like that. Definitely monthly x-rays and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I was non-weight bearing status for 3 months. So 90 days is what they said. You're not to bear weight. Don't even think about standing up. Those bone fragments that we've pinned, plated, and glued back together need to mend. So don't put weight on it. So I didn't. And after the 3 month mark, I got cleared to bear weight. And then that's when like rehab really starts.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause other than that, I was just, you know, bound to a wheelchair. So, the time I was in the wheelchair, it was all damage control. I was, you know, prescribed heavy narcotics, Oxycontin, Tramadol, like two heavy narcotics that are just destroying lives. Hmm. So I knew that step one, get off the narcs, get off all prescription narcs. So I was able to do that within 60 days of the accident.
How hard was that?
Not hard for me. Not hard. Yep. You know, definitely was physically addicted to a lot of the opiates, Oxycontin. I was physically addicted first dosage. I think I was on 12 hour increments of Oxy, and by hour 10, I'd start to lose my mind. Just raging, dude. The pain and the withdrawals overwhelming. But I remember this. So the last day I ever took a prescription narc was the day that I met Stephen Murray. At the 2010 Supercross BMX race down at the Olympic Training Center. Mm-hmm. Katie Holden came out to Pine Valley, picked me up, drove me down to the race. No way.
That's awesome.
And on our way out, you know, like Katie's pushing me around. Bless her, dude, such a sweetheart. Pushing me around in a wheelchair and there's Stephen Murray. So Murray and I met, had a chat, and dude, he had this like crazy aura, like that just, I just picked up on it, man. I was like, dude, this dude is so strong. Like, I'm done with it, dude. I'm going to beat this. Like, I can beat this pain. Like, if this guy can function, he has like no use of anything. He can talk, and he's far worse off than I am. Like, I don't know, man. He just that interaction with Stephen Murray chair was life-changing. Wow. for me I don't think anyone would have that kind of interaction with Stephen. It's different when you're in the thick of it, you I'm know sure. and you're
yeah
you're like a ground zero with a heavy traumatic situation. Yeah. I don't know, it'd be more like war veterans, you know what I mean? Like, we can never relate to what some of these vets are going through.
Sure.
Because we're not fighting war. I
haven't experienced it.
Yeah, I haven't experienced it. So, yeah, that just, like, that incident with Steven just gave me the positive charge I needed to make that next step, which, again, it's all mental, man. Like, the drug addiction, it's all between your ears. For anyone battling addiction, like, you can drop it. You just have to, like, it's on you. That's it. So I just accepted it, took accountability and stopped doing prescription narcs and just relied on cannabis to kill the pain. Which, you know, again, that was like damage control. My family fully supported that. They're like, look, we don't know too many junkies out there on cannabis, but you know, heroin's wrecking people.
Sure.
So, yeah, step one before I even got out of the wheelchair was to get off the narcs. And dude, within the first week off the prescription narcs, massive gains in recovery, massive gains, like way less nerve pain. You know, my moods kind of stabilized a little bit.
Yeah.
And like, dude, just like I could feel like my skin felt healthier. My fingernails were thicker. My hair felt healthier. Crazy. Like you feel it. Like you know, I was very, very, very like hyper aware of just everything at that time. But yeah, getting out of the wheelchair and getting to learn how to walk again, then it was just this complex sequence of events. I kind of naturally reverted back to yoga to open up my hips and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I was working with the yoga teacher who I was actually working with. Her name's Lisa. I was working with Lisa when I was racing.
Okay.
And it's funny, like the season leading up to my crash, we were opening up my hips. Mm. Like that's what I was really focusing on. All my training portion of things was like opening up hip mobility for better performance on the downhill bike.
Interesting.
So we basically picked up where we had left off.
Okay.
But with a restart, you know, so getting into some of these poses took some time.
I bet.
And dude, it was so painful.
Yeah.
But it was really just kind of an evolution. So Aaron Gwynn started working with Ryan Hughes that 2011. Okay. When he got on Trek and just started mopping the floor with people.
That's Rhino Power.
Rhino Power, yeah. Ryan Hughes. So Aaron reached out to Rhino on my behalf and said, "Look, dude, I got a buddy who's pretty messed up, and you know he could use your help." Hmm. So the Rhino was very gracious. He met with me, basically consulted with me for about 90 minutes, and kind of just showed me the way.
Hmm.
You know, like this is how we do things. You know, this is how these motocross athletes are training. This is how Aaron's training. Here's just kind of the systemic deal. Like here's some tips on diet. Here's some just protocol on working out, like how to warm up, how to get through it, how to cool down. And he didn't charge me. So I respected that. And I'm very, very, very grateful, Rhino, that you took the time to meet with me. It changed my life, man, for the better. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. As a teacher, hopefully that makes your day. But I had so much respect for Rhino and the knowledge that he attained. And I know that stuff's not cheap, and I just straight up didn't have the money to see him. And I respected it. Like I didn't want him to, you know, I didn't want to be a charity case, sure. I guess, you know, like just have too much respect for people and their professions and their skill. So I just sort of took that consultation and ran with it and continued to do my own due diligence and research and, you know, diet and, you know, obviously I got pretty lean there for a few years, mm-hmm. and that was very much intentional. I was on a pretty strict plant-based diet. You know, I was eating about 2 pounds of spinach a week.
Wow. Really? Two pounds.
Yeah. I was crushing heavy on the grains, just heavy on the plant matter, for a couple parts. So I knew that, I needed to clean out the narcotics, you know, from my system. Those things linger for a while.
Hmm.
I ended up getting into acupuncture. Acupuncture was so and is the most like intense thing for pain management. So I've never found anything more beneficial for pain, instant for pain management than acupuncture. It's phenomenal.
Hmm.
But you just got to be open to it. I guess when you're so battered and you're so desperate to get better, like I was open to trying anything.
Yeah. Dude. Why not? Like what do you got to lose?
I had nothing to lose. Yeah. You want to bless me? I'll take all the blessings I can get. You know what I mean? Like pray for me. No shame here. So yeah, dude, it was just a real systemic, just a multi-prong approach to getting better. Hmm. And I never really stopped kind of progressing. I'm still progressing. I mean, the nerve damage in my right leg is getting better and better and better. And I mean, nowadays you could barely tell that my right calf and left calf were ever any different size.
Huh,
you know, but there's still limited motor function and feeling in my right leg. Yeah. So basically recovery was I owned it. I just owned up to it and took accountability. And fortunately, there was a lot of amazing people out there that were willing to work with me. I understood my money situation and lack thereof. Mm-hmm. So I was, getting awesome discounted rates and certain things. Like I was doing the acupuncture treatments in an apartment down in Pacific Beach.
Wow, really?
Like, yeah, I really got close with Ian Collins around that time because Ian was neighbors with the guys.
Huh, cool.
The guy, it was a couple. But yeah, I was getting acupuncture and PB in an apartment twice a week. Definitely,
off the record.
Definitely off the record. But that's what you got to do, man. Sure. Like if you're in that bad of a situation in the United States of America, you got to get creative. Hmm. I'm convinced. So, because yeah, like I think it's anywhere in the world. Like these doctors have rules that they got to stick to. So yeah. Sometimes that's not always the best for you, the patient.
Yeah. How long did it take you to get back on a bike?
I actually rode a beach cruiser again, Christmas Day, 2010. Hmm. So not even a year for me to get back on a bike.
Okay.
So actually mountain biking, it was even less than a year, but wow, very adaptive, really? Very, very adaptive. Oh, dude. Yeah. I jumped into it. Yeah, I jumped into it. I took an aggressive, like, I have nothing to lose approach to getting better.
Okay.
So, and I definitely was still of that kind of like die trying warrior racer mindset. So yeah. I was like, yeah, I'm going to die trying getting better. I have nothing to lose here. I think I was riding Snow Summit summer of 2011.
I didn't realize it was that quick. That's awesome.
Well, dude, but it was sketchy though. Like, so my right leg was highly, highly, I couldn't feel it or use it. It literally felt like a prosthetic leg.
Yeah.
Like from the knee to the, through to the foot, I had like, I couldn't feel, I couldn't tell you what was going on. I had sensitivity of the tongue of my shoe. And that was my pressure gauge, So driving a car, my throttle foot, I literally used the tongue of my shoe to tell me that I was pressing down on the gas because I couldn't feel the pedal. Uh-huh. Jeez, but I just pretty much, I got some really good advice from Stacy Kohut.
Hmm.
Kohut is a, paraplegic. Yeah. He's been for, 20 plus years now.
Yeah. Dude, I'd love to get him on here someday.
Oh, Stacy Kohut is amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Amazing soul. Stacy called me a few months into my recovery, intentionally. And he was like, look, dude, I wanted to let the dust settle a little bit and kind of let you get, let your brain kind of come to and stuff like that. But Stacy just encouraged me to treat this comeback very seriously, have the state of mind of returning to World Cup racing.
Hmm.
Right. He said, like, put the goal of getting back to the World Cup level. Like, that should be your goal.
Wow.
And I was like, yeah, Stacy, you're right. That's exactly it. Like, I have no idea if that's possible. I can't even lift my right leg right now, but you're right. Like, that's just mentally what you need.
Yeah. Why not set that goal in your head?
Why not set the goal? Yeah. And Stacy had it even built up. He's like, yeah, dude, what you should do is get to the World Cup level. And then when you get there, retire. Oh, I love you, Stacy, but I'm not McGrath, dude. Like, I'm not that big of a deal. But I did. I definitely had like the intent of like being a world-class racer again. And that, man, just that gives you some mental strength to push through some really, really, really tough, painful times. I had to walk. Let me put it this way, Spomer. I was walking around with a cane and like could throw a leg over a bike and still rip like pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It was sketchy though. Cause like I said, dude, my right foot was so such a liability. Like it could come flying off the pedal at any moment. And
Like you kind of didn't know.
Didn't know. Yeah, I didn't know. I would just have to react. So,
did we do a JRA on the beach cruiser with your cane? We did. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
dig that out. Okay.
Yeah. So did that JRA, and I was, I think I was like just maybe starting to get on a bike again.
Yeah, I think so.
Around that time.
Yeah.
Like it was hard for me to just throw a leg over the bike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm like, hey, let's go ride, Chris. Come on.
Yep. So I think I walked with a cane for about the first year. Honestly, I could use a cane today.
Yeah.
My left hip is it's all soft tissue, man. Like right now I needed to just get it back to length.
Yeah.
So spending now 5 years solid at a desk has caused another set of issues. But I guess, man, with recovery, it's ongoing, mm-hmm. You know, 8 years later, like it's just, I have a whole new way of living my life.
Yeah. And it's going to be that way forever.
It's going to be that way forever. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Yep. I have to get more disciplined as I age.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like where I'm at now is like getting back to some, like I gotta incorporate a little bit more discipline and, you know, back off some M&Ms.
But they're so tasty. All right. We're at the 2 hour mark. So let's touch on what you're doing with Deity and then we'll head on out.
Okay.
So talk about Deity. One of the things I was thinking of is like, you know, everyone gets a title like, oh, it's Eric Davies, owner of Deity, or it's like, you know, Stickman over at Troy Lee. It's like, what do we call you? You're like an ATV dude. You're kind of everything to everyone in mountain biking, but what are you doing at Deity?
So I am the national sales manager and fresh blood grassroots team manager.
Okay.
So working for a small company, you wear multiple hats naturally.
For sure. Yeah.
So yeah, I was hired on to do US dealer sales and the grassroots program. Which is such an amazing opportunity and you know, props to Eric Davies for having the wherewithal to create this position that suits the needs of everybody, Deity and myself. You know, for me doing the fresh blood grassroots team, somebody's got to manage that. But Eric saw like, hey, no, this role, we could have anybody do this. We could have whatever, any rider can do this part-time. But Eric wanted me managing the grassroots team because he just sees a need for me to stay connected with riders and ride and riding and racing.
Yeah.
And so for me to vicariously live through the grassroots team and to share knowledge, dude, that's valuable beyond a paycheck for me. He sees that, you know what I mean? Like spiritually is fulfilling.
Yeah,
you know
sure.
what I mean?
Cause that's what you're hoping to do with the X-Fusion thing before everything
exactly.
went downhill.
Yeah, yeah exactly. Huh. Develop talent. Yeah. So I'm still able to do that. So I think that's amazing that, you know, Eric sees that. And then the sales side of things, that's, you know, so post-injury, obviously having like the World Cup body in mind was the end goal for recovery. But let me just touch on like, so I did actually get to a competitive level. And in 2013, I went down and raced a Red Bull street race in Brazil, you know, against like the pros down there. And I was riding like with a bunch of rippers and I really came to the conclusion that my body is just not capable of handling the demands of downhill racing today. Okay. Not in my day, not today. I just can't do it. So naturally I had to get savvy and figure out, okay, where does a guy like me go in this industry? Mm-hmm. And, you know, sales is something that, I think people who are good at communicating kind of gravitate to. But for me, I kind of saw it of like, well, being in sales is like a really good career move because I can kind of control my destiny. I'm not dependent on a company to be healthy to support my pay. Like I'm supposed to be making the company healthy, i.e. growing the bottom line.
Yeah.
And that way everybody can get paid and eat, you know? So I saw that of like, it's how you position yourself. I kind of need to position myself over there. So first before Deity came up again, like, so the second time I came to what I thought was the end of the road for mountain biking is Interbike 2013.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd come back and like was doing a bit of racing, but really like kind of getting back into some freelance media stuff. And struggling, okay. You know, it's literally struggling to eat at times. And, you know, my dad was like, look, dude, you're 28 years old. You're not living in my house for much longer. You need to go. So I had some ideas to pitch to some people in 2013 going to Interbike. But again, I was like, dude, if none of this sticks, then I might have to go back to school and like, figure out how I'm going to stand and like be a chef or something like that. You know, like culinary school was kind of the fallback plan. So I'm going up to Kyle Straits actually early. I went to Straits in that 2013 to go to Interbike, and then we went out to scout the Rampage site for him to go win it that year. And I get a text from my friend Trevor Reese, who is a Pine Valley kid.
Yeah.
So another unique thing about Pine Valley, California, it's pumped out two pretty badass racers, one pro supercross guy and a World Cup qualified downhill racer. So for a town of 2,000 people, it's pretty sick.
Yeah, for sure.
In the middle of nowhere. So Trevor Reese is, you know, grew up racing motocross and had support from Maxima Racing Oils for forever. So Trevor texts me and goes, "Hey, dude, yeah, like I want to introduce you to Danny Massey. He owns Maxima, super smart guy. They're going to launch a commercial bike line. And they're looking for a guy who's connected and can like run the bike division."
Yeah.
So long story short, I meet the guys at Maxima and boom.
Game on. I kind of always wondered how you got in there, like just how it worked out.
So through Trevor Reese, through friends, like old relationships.
Yeah, cool.
So this position at Maxima was created for me to manage the commercial bike line. So Maxima has had a long-standing OEM relationship with various suspension manufacturers in mountain biking since I picked up my first mountain bike action.
Wow, actually, really?
Before that. Okay. Yeah. But they wanted to do a commercial line, right? So I chain lubes and things like that sold to bike shops.
Right.
I jumped on that opportunity. One, I needed a job. Two, that was an opportunity I just could not pass up.
Huh, cool.
So I worked at Maxima Racing Oils for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And Eric and Sadie at Deity watched what I was doing. And again, like I was essentially a one-man operation bringing this sick brand with this amazing racing pedigree like into a new market, really. Solely, you know, just it was me.
Yeah.
Under the guidance of Danny Massey and Steve Benson, like two super, super smart. The Maxima for me was like a real life MBA program.
Dude, that's cool to hear. I don't know why, like just mentally, it's probably because I knew who you were and like kind of watched you come up, but like maybe to just see you in like a 9-to-5 for the first time. In the back of my head, it's always like, oh man, Grizz is pinned down. But that's rad to hear. It was so good for you.
Oh, it was incredible. You know? And dude, my story like completely tied in. Like myself and Maxima was like this perfect fit.
Yeah, it sounds like,
dude,
it.
Because Maxima was founded by the Lachines. It's a Dogger, dude. Like Dogger, although Dogger was way more accomplished than I ever was in downhill racing. He was in motocross, you know, the motocross, the nations guy. Like Dogger was the dude that would show up to supercross with a hangover and win. You know what I mean? Like that dude is a 2.6 stallion at heart. So I was like this natural fit to Maxima as a company. And my story, like this abandoned racer that had to get his life together, like, dude, perfect fit. Really couldn't have been a better fit.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I learned a lot at Maxima, business and the ins and outs of biking. I've got all this killer lubricant information that I never thought I'd ever have. I can help you make a fork feel really freaking good, Palmer.
Okay.
You want to talk brake fluids? We talk brake fluids. Chain lubes? Let's get lubricious. So, in my time at Maxima, I really learned a lot about business, a brand. What's a brand? You know, the ethos and all that stuff. Bringing stories to life and managing distributors and doing sales, going to bike shops. So, I would always see. You know, most of us always see Eric and Sadie at Sea Otter Classic.
Yep.
Some of us, that's all the only times you ever get to see Eric and Sadie.
Mm-hmm.
So, Eric and Sadie took note of like every time. I'd show up to as Maxima Racing Oils. By me, I'd be the only boots on the ground. We'd have no tent, but like, dude, I had Maxima like over here. We had this bike wash station. I'm lining up like OEM accounts in these pits. Like they just saw me running around knowing that shit's getting done.
Yeah.
Like this one guy is carrying the weight of like a team. So I I've had a long-standing relationship with Eric and Sadie too, dating back to, you know, 06 through like Cameron and Kyle.
Yeah.
Cam Zink has been Deity day one. So
yep.
Same with, Kyle was one of the Deity originals too. So they, you know, they just saw what I was doing and they had these lofty ambitions to grow Deity and they knew that they needed to staff up to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
The company had grown to a point where they reached a crossroads. It either stays this mom and pop company or we take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
We apply some risk and we staff up and we make a charge. So I'm glad they took the risk. They took the risk on me and started courting me, starting in 2015.
Wow, really?
You know, in 2015, summer 15, they're like, hey, you should probably think about coming up here. You know, I came up to Boise for a Western Power Sports event.
You know, for Maxima. Boise.
Boise.
You sound like you're fully local now, yeah.
Well, dude, I'm not trying to Californicate Idaho, man.
Boise.
Boise for you guys out there. That's how you do it. But yeah, I came up here for a Maxima deal through Western Power Sports and came up a little early, spent time with Eric and Sadie.
Oh, dude. Was I at that thing?
No. Jeff Bryans came for Vital.
Okay.
Did I say his last name right?
Yeah, Bryans.
Yeah,
okay.
Bryans. Yeah, Jeff. All right. Yeah, Jeff came. So in 2015, I saw Boise for the first time as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, whoa, this place is pretty sick. Kind of reminds me of like Big Bear, like the terrain, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
And we did a ride from Bogus Basin all the way down to downtown. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, dude, sick. It's like a 16-mile shuttle.
Yeah.
And there's killer restaurants, this killer kind of like hipster vibe down here. This place is cool. I could get down Boise.
Uh-huh.
By 2016, Eric and Sadie were like, look, Grizz, you need to make a decision. Are you coming or are you not?
Like they're going to be moving on
and,
to someone
and,
else.
And honestly, like I was really, really happy with Maxima and I didn't accomplish what needed to be accomplished there.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely felt like there was a lot more to come. And, but man, I took a step back and was like, wait, you know, beyond like a paycheck, I got to like really evaluate my life here. I'm in my 30s now. I'm in this industry. I'm a bike industry guy. Unless you're an owner of one of these brands or like a CEO, high level exec, and even if you get to that level, there's like a ceiling for your income. And, you know, at my level nowadays, like I'm not set up to sustain life in Southern California as a marketing guy, as a sales guy, it's going to be tough. You know, you can pull a 6-figure income in Southern California and feel poor. I realized that. I was like, ooh, but I go up to Idaho. This is a different ballgame. My life is going to change. Like I'm not ever going to like dream about buying a house. It's like, you know, when am I going to buy a house now? So I had to factor in a lot of things and I'm glad I made the commitment to come up to Deity. You know, the parting of ways with Maxima was good. I mean, on good terms, I should say. Like, I think we all miss each other. I definitely miss Steve and Danny and the whole crew at Maxima, but you know, we still hang out whenever they come up to Western Power Sports. We'll go hammered or go maybe ride one of these days. But yeah, I pulled the trigger 2 years ago to the day. As we record this, it's August 13th. Yeah. So yeah, 2 years ago, I was moving into a little bungalow over here in Boise.
Huh. Here you are.
Here I am. And beyond like the personal gains monetarily and positioning myself to buy a house, being a part of Deity and doing what we're doing is very rare in industries. Like the skateboard industry has seen companies grow in a super sick way. Like I think World Industries, like what Rocco did. I guess what I'm getting at is what Deity is doing as a company as a brand is never going to be repeated in this industry. I don't ever see it happening again.
Yeah.
And not just like a contact point company, but like this independently owned company that started literally with very, 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 very humble beginnings.
Yep.
And built this army of badass riders and I get the opportunity to come in and make things, you know, shake things around and grow this company to the next level to where it's going to staff up and more people are going to get paid and careers are going to be made and, you know, people's lives should effectively be awesome. Those that, you know, as we grow, you come here, like you can make a bike industry wage and like have a good life in Idaho. So to be a part of something that's way bigger than you'll ever be is such a sick feeling. You know, like I can easily sign up for a 9-to-5. And I know some of you are out there like, ah, 9-to-5, it's a death sentence. Never. Dude, I love what I do. And I get to wake up and I get to help make bike shops more profitable. I get to help, you know, make rider salaries more profitable. Dude, it's sick. Like, yeah, just, yeah, I get really, really fired up doing what I'm doing with Deity.
Awesome.
And couldn't be doing it for a better group of people. Yeah, it's cool, dude.
Dude, it's, my face hurts from smiling, dude. Just, I don't know. It's just cool to see everyone happy and it just following what they want to do.
It worked out. Yeah, and you've seen lower times, Sean. You've definitely seen me where I'm like, cross-eyed on oxycodone and can't move my legs. And
yeah, but
here I am.
Yeah, stoked to see where you are in the next, how long ago was that, 10 years ago? Not even, 8 years ago?
Yikes, yeah.
So.
Well, things, I don't know, man, Masters World Champs is at Mount St. Anne 2019.
Oh, that's dude, that's going to be a melter. Yeah. Everyone's going to that.
Yeah, I might have to join that party.
Do it, let's get on the boat.
Yeah, that'll be another carrot, dude, another carrot to get me lean. Yep. I know all the... Well, my friends out there, they love, you know, picking on me for being chubby and stuff like that. But yeah, we'll get the 300 body going again and go show up to Mount St. Anne in 2019.
Sweet.
That sounds good to me.
Dude, thanks, man. That was awesome. Yeah,
thank you, Sean. When are we going to reverse the tables and get you going on this, man? We need to question you.
Why? I'm just sitting here.
The mythical creature.
People.
You're like the Wizard of Oz, dude.
Heart tried, but it kind of fell apart before I left. So, yeah. I have to get back down there. Maybe we'll do it. I want him to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Scott would be the guy. Yeah. Scott would definitely be the guy. You and Scott Hart are like two of the, in my opinion, biggest behind the scenes influencers of this sport.
Is that good or bad?
It's
I don't know.
Great thing. No,
Scott,
man, dude,
I know is good. But.
Think about like the stories that you guys have told and the riders, like these heroes that you guys have helped build. You're invaluable, dude.
I guess.
You're invaluable. I love you, Spomer.
Thanks.
For
love
real.
Love you too, Chris.
For real.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Well, thank you guys for listening to me chew the fat here for
dude,
a long time.
Sick. They're always so good. I love these things. I never want them to end. Tell us a 2019 team rumor and we'll bleep it out.
Oh. It's a little early. It is a little
it
early.
Is.
The
I
only
know.
Only like, one I have is that we're... No, I don't even have a rumor because it's like it's all like early talks.
I know, it's so
early
yeah.
talks.
We started the thread, so I figured I'd try
but
to get something going.
You might see 2019.
All right, I like that one. That's good. All right,
he's a badass, so he'd be a good fit for the program.
Yeah, dude, seems perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sick. All right. Peace.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to Vital MTB's The Inside Line Podcast. Episodes drop every other Wednesday. Thanks to Jensen USA and Maxxis Tires for the support. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at VitalMTB.